Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to call to order the Tuesday, October 7th Carson City Parks and Recreation Commission meeting. Could we have the roll call, please?
Chairperson Lehman.
Here.
Vice Chairperson Long. Here. Commissioner Adams. Commissioner Cassioppo.
Here.
Commissioner Colburn.
Here.
Commissioner Curtis.
Here.
Commissioner Glenn. Commissioner Kiever. Commissioner McKenna.
Here.
A quorum's present.
Okay, and yeah, for the record, both Commissioner Adams and Commissioner Kiever did state that they would be absent, so they have been excused. Is there any public comments at this time not relating to the agenda?
Right.
Here we go.
For the record, C.K. Bailey, Chairman, Commissioners. Oh, yeah, 3-minute timer. Thank you very much for allowing me this time. For your information, to inform you, my October volunteer hours for Parks and Rec amount to 4.5 hours and 20 miles. And that's for cleaning up the Bailey Pond facility, getting it in shape. And the pond itself is in excellent shape. And due to falling temperatures at night, it looks like the fishing's picking up really well. And Dow is starting to stock trout. They're rainbow and brown. So if you have a number 16 tan bird's nest, you should do well for all those who are interested whatsoever. So the Nevada Department of Wildlife is stocking. Okay, I do not know how Parks and Rec actually repaired the rain damage that occurred this year to the pond, especially the south and east side. That occurred this year. I am just really very thankful that they did repair it. And so are a lot of people, as is noticed. There are just dozens of people out there today and yesterday. They're already, the drums are beating. So there's fishing going on in Carson City. So on behalf of a little grandmother and her littlest granddaughter with the blonde hair, pink lawn chair, and Barbie fishing pole and Barbie fishing net, I want to thank Parks and Rec once again for having this pond and for keeping it going. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bailey. Yeah, I know I've gone fishing a couple times at the pond this summer. So,
nice.
And when did they stock last, you know?
About a week ago.
Okay. I better go back down, huh?
There's about 700 fish in there.
Sorry. Yes. In answer to your question, Chairman Sean, yes, there's about 700 fish minus about a week's worth of lots of folks figuring it out and looking at the NDAO website where they can find out what the status is of the stockings of all waters in this area. Okay, so endow.org will tell you.
Okay, the secret's out. All right, thank you very much. Any commissioner comments? Okay, so we're going to go into item number one, which is possible action on approval of minutes, and this was the minutes from the last meeting, which was September. I was able to review those. Does anybody have a motion to approve those?
I'll make a motion to approve them.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, so we've approved those. Item number two, modifications to the agenda. Do we have any modifications tonight?
The only modification I would suggest is that we just pull item, I think it's 4A, it's an update on the disc golf course. The information we were hoping to have available for you folks tonight is not going to be available, so we really don't have really anything to tell you. We hope that we'll have some information for the next meeting in November for you.
Okay, is that so? I guess we're just kind of status quo at the moment with that. All right, so I guess we can scratch that one. Have we heard from the supporters of the disc golf at all in the last?
We've had some conversations with them individually, not as a group, though.
Okay, and what information were we hoping to?
Well, we're kind of getting to the point where we're kind of giving an update of information we don't have to give you an update of, but really the right now the status of the disc golf course is still the same as it has been. We're waiting for land transfer from BLM and discussing other issues. So, okay. But we don't have the information we'd hope to have bring to you tonight yet here.
Why don't we just keep that one there and we'll make it exceptionally brief then. It sounds like there's not much to go over. So is there anything else?
Nope.
All right. We'll move right on to meeting items. Item number 3A is a presentation and discussion only by Tyler Torres, Eagle Scout candidate, on the successful completion of his California Trail Interpretive Sign project. So this will be both Tyler and Vern.
I'll just kick it off and then I'll turn it over to Tyler real quick. As you'll remember, a few meetings ago, Tyler was here and gave everybody a quick overview of what his Eagle Scout project was going to be. We're excited to report in tonight that it is done, and Tyler's going to share with you, put together a PowerPoint presentation, and he's going to go through that with you, kind of share the success of what it's been for us. So, Tyler, go ahead.
All right, thank you. So, we did the California Immigrant Trail project. That was on September 13th, a Saturday. It started around 8:30 in the morning and was finished by about 1 o'clock or 1:30. Mm-hmm. This project was, in my opinion, completed very successfully. It ran very smoothly with very few impediments. So to start off, we've got the basic overview of the entire project. We came together, planned out details, all the different kinds of specifics that we would need for the project, including materials, tools, supplies, volunteers, et al. After that, logistics such as safety times, locations, measurements, and that brought us to actually executing the project. Now we are to the step where we're going to be looking back and evaluating. So, site selection, we've got Vern up there. We looked at many possible sites. I believe it came to 12 different sites, and using an evaluation matrix, we were able to limit it to the linear park trail that's right off next to Fremont School. So there was a sign there originally, which we had to relocate to give room for the other signs and to make it a more appropriate location for the Weeds and Natives sign. That was going to be part of the project, or that was part of the project, not dealt with yet. So before the project actually took place, here's about what it looked like. What the trail looked like by Fremont. You can see the bridge and weeds all around. It was a lot. Then we made plans at the site, including just very detailed amounts of very detailed measurements for where every single post, every icon, every just marking would go. After that, I marked them off with stakes so that we would not lose the locations. Once that was done, we picked up some decorative boulders from Basalite, which was really, really generous of Jeremy, the owner there. Then we started the actual project, which was pulling weeds to begin, then relocating the Weeds and Native sign to a more appropriate location that's over slightly south of Fremont. After that, we began digging all the rest of the holes that everyone would need for the regular signs. After putting up all the signs, we cleaned up from the project and, we had many people there. I believe it amounted to 20 altogether. It ran really, really smoothly. Definitely thanks to tons of help, or tons of guidance from Vern beforehand, and then, it ran very, very well. So once we finished up with with the whole project, we've got kind of rocks off to the left-hand side, which we arranged in kind of a campfire style so that it would look more like here's what the pilgrims would be, not pilgrims, but the, I don't know where pilgrims came from, the immigrants, they came from England. Pilgrims came from England, everyone knows. So, immigrants, that's kind of the feeling, the style that we were hoping to establish with those rocks, just what the immigrants might have been feeling or seeing, doing. After that, you've got the different signs and the icon to the right, which is not bad. And another view. Oh, this is after checking in 3 days later to make sure that everything had set very nicely so that it would not be blown over, it would not fall, anything like that. That big icon in the middle, really heavy. So then we checked, and everything's cleared of weeds. We sprinkled tons of seeds in, raked them in. It should be sprouting lots of new vegetation by this coming spring, which it'll look really good. I'm excited. Are there any questions? Oh, we also had a sign-in sheet, which is a bit small and you can't see it very well. But, yeah, lots of people. Are there any questions?
So, great job. So I believe you're in 341, right? Troop 341? 65. Okay, Jeremy's in 341, but good. Great job. I mean, that's perfect. And I was reading in the paper about how you have like a 4.8 grade point average or something like that. So real sharp. Perfect job. Vern, I'm sure you're ecstatic about the results here.
Oh, absolutely. Tyler's been great to work with. We've enjoyed getting to know him and working through this process. And it's been good. It's been really easy working with him, and I think he's done a great job for us.
Commissioner comments. Joe.
Tyler, I was just curious how long the construction took.
Do you mean the construction of the sign itself, or like putting everything up, or do you mean the planning and everything?
Both.
Okay, so for me, I put in 49 hours and 10 minutes. Overall, it was just slightly over 130 hours, and constructing the signs, not constructing them, erecting the signs took only 4.5 hours. That was after moving the weeds and native signs, as well as digging the holes, setting the concrete, all that.
Tyler, who did the design on the signs, and what part of that did you have in the overall design?
I believe that the design of the signs, all the information that was on them, the maps, the design of the big icon in the middle, that was all pre-taken care of. That works. It was all taken care of in advance by the state of California.
Yeah, a little more information on that. Going back a little ways, Linda Ritter, when she was over in Elko, ran across in Elko they have the Overland Trail Interpretive Center over there. And this was a joint venture between California and the state of Nevada to put up these different signs all along the route. This is very typical. If you're driving along I-80, there are a number of spots that you can pull off, rest areas that you'll find signs similar to this with different stories about those locations. They also have one down in Genoa, down at the Mormon State Church, Mormon State Fort down there. Very similar, same icon, same panels, just a different story in each of the panels. There's one panel that's consistent throughout both Nevada and California that talks about the overall project, and then there's one specifically to the area that was located. This was done, this was funded through California State Legislature, and it has, these are all up, and unfortunately I have to say we're one of the last ones to get up the signs, but we're excited to have been able to do that with the Nevada State Parks and their partnership with the state of California.
Anyone else on the commission?
Did Butch sign in? Butch the Ghost?
I was looking for Butch the Ghost, and I'm pretty sure I didn't see him.
Anyone else?
Yes.
Commissioner Curtis.
Thank you very much for doing this for us. And I'm wondering, did any aspect of this, did you think about what you might want to do in the future that has any relationship to this sort of thing? Or are you going to do something totally different?
Oh, do you mean as far as a career or occupation would go?
Right.
In that regard, I think I'm still pretty set on either piloting or something into the medical field, but this was definitely a good experience. I did learn quite a bit about leadership, community service. It was definitely something beneficial.
Commissioner Long.
I think you probably have a senior project or something going. Did you have anything else you wanted to do before finish it off? Just wondering. Anyway, I'm just kidding. But good job. And I actually went out for a run not too long ago and kind of made a loop around there, and I saw your signs. So they look very good, and I appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay, so you're a senior this year, right? So you got college plans yet for next year?
As far as college is going, it's a lot. I'm applying to many, many places, Westminster, Purdue, Embry-Riddle, of course, the ones that everyone applies to but no one gets, Stanford, Yale, Harvard. Yeah, all those. I'm applying to many places, but my top choices would either be Stanford for its business school or Embry-Riddle for its flight school, because Embry-Riddle is amazing. I'm definitely excited for that.
My vote's Embry-Riddle. That's a good pilot program. I flew a plane from Embry-Riddle for quite a few years, so pilot's a good thing. So best of luck to you. I know you've been very successful at school. It's a very successful project. Looks great. So, yeah, we appreciate all your work and effort on that. Are there any public comments on this item? All right, Tyler, thank you very much. And you should be getting your Eagle then soon, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good job. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so we can move on to item number 3B, which is a discussion only regarding the recipients for the Foundation for the Betterment of Carson City Parks and Recreation Awards for 2014. So I guess this is Roger.
Yeah, we were expecting David Bugley, who's the president of the Foundation for the Betterment of Carson City Parks and Recreation, to be here tonight to kind of help present these, but I'll go ahead and do it. The Foundation for the Betterment of Carson City Parks and Recreation have announced their annual awards given to individuals, organizations, and businesses who have made significant contribution to Carson City Parks and Recreation in the community as a whole in the past year or over the years. This year, the Foundation has come up with an astounding slate of awardees. You have that listed on Exhibit A. The award ceremony to honor these recipients is scheduled for 4:30 p.m., Tuesday, October 21st, 2014, at the Monument near the entry of the Marv Texera Pavilion. So, you know, we'd like to invite all the members of the Parks and Recreation Commission to attend that. I know many of you attend that every year. And then at that time, the recipients will unveil their names that are inscribed in the monument. Traditionally, the awards are as follows: Volunteer of the Year, Volunteer of the Years, Business of the Year, and Organization of the Year. This year, the Foundation kind of went a little bit different route, and they made a decision to present a one-time-only special recognition award to Marv Texera, Al Texera, and Matt Texera for their longtime support of youth sports. And so if you bear with me, in Exhibit A, we have the individuals and a write-up on each individual or organization. And just for the sake of reading this, having this in the record, I'd like to read it into the record. So again, the Volunteer of the Year is Donna Iverson. Over the last 3 years, Donna has been a great asset to the Parks and Recreation Department by overseeing the Easy Walk and Easy Bike program, along with being a trail advocate. She dedicates her time to discovering new trails and possible walking and biking paths to take all who are interested. She takes into consideration all ages and abilities when deciding where to take the group next. On her own time, she guides approximately 4 walks per month, and during the summer of 2014, she offered 2 community bike rides per month around Carson City, exposing the participants to new areas and trails that they may not have known about. She has planned and organized community volunteer efforts to remove garbage and debris in our recreation areas along the Carson River and continues to envision future opportunities for new trail development. The Carson City Parks and Recreation Department enjoys working with Donna and appreciates all that she has given back to our wonderful community. And as kind of a side note, an interesting thing about Donna is that she started this Easy Walk program a couple of years ago, and at the time she would struggle. Maybe she'd have half a dozen to or less people show up for these walk programs, and they've really grown tremendously over the years. I don't know if any of you have participated in any of her programs, but occasionally we'll go down, and if we have time, and walk with them. And I think the last time I walked with them, there must have been about 40 people in the walk, so it has really grown. It's become quite popular. And then on the bike side, I think what's really interesting about the bike program is that Donna herself had never ridden a bike and only learned how to ride a bike a couple years ago. And so Donna's, you know, she's I probably shouldn't disclose her age, but she's, you know, she's a middle-aged woman. And, you know, pardon me?
She is a woman of certain age.
She's a woman of certain age. Thank you. That's probably the political correct way of saying that, isn't it? But if you can imagine, you know, becoming a person of a certain age and have never ridden a bicycle before and how difficult that might be, and she ended up falling in love with riding bicycles around the community. So it's kind of neat that somebody who had just learned how to ride a bike would take it upon themselves to lead these bike rides, I think, in the community. So our congratulations go out to Donna. Sure.
Since you commented, I guess this would be appropriate time to comment if you know one of these people. I've known Donna almost as long as I've lived here. And I think she's been doing these walks almost that long. It's been years and years she's been doing them. We started out by trying to walk inside here in the gym, and everybody wanted to be outside. So we would tromp through the snow in Mills Park. And actually, one of your staff people was helping us with the walks at that time, too. But Don, when she took it on, you knew it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been steady ever since, and you can always depend on it, unless, you know, she falls or something happens. So hopefully not. But anyway, she is a great person and well-deserving of this.
Next one is our Volunteer of the Years, and that's being awarded to Rex Jennings. I don't know if any of you know Rex. We got a comment from the audience. For 12 years running now, Rex Jennings has volunteered his time performing a variety of tasks and functions at Lone Mountain Cemetery. He provides some minor maintenance, assists customers with questions, and helps in locating grave sites, putting out and raising the flags on holidays, and various other duties. He has overseen 3 Eagle Scout projects. 2 were improvement projects involving the installation of a lighted flagpole and a kiosk at Empire Cemetery, and a 3rd that is in progress at Lone Mountain Cemetery. This current project is making grave markers for indigent graves that have no identifying markers, which is a much needed and worthwhile project. Probably the most notable thing Rex does for us is he locks up the cemetery gates every evening at dusk, 7 days a week, and unlocks the cemetery in the early morning during the weekends and holidays. And he does that because I couldn't get Vern to do it. He does this at a sacrifice of his own personal time and expense, as he does so with his own personal vehicle and receives no compensation for fuel costs. We have offered, and he has declined our efforts to be monetarily compensated. This function alone saves us a considerable amount of funding annually if paid staff perform this. Rex is a skilled welder by trade, has done numerous welding and metal fabricating projects for not only our department, but other city departments as well. We are pleased and honored to award Rex Jennings the 2014 Volunteer of the Year's Award. So Rex has been a real stalwart for us and done a lot of good work. The next one is Organization of the Year, and this one is going to the Carson City Redevelopment Authority Citizens Committee, otherwise known as RAC. The Carson City Redevelopment Authority Citizens Committee continues to use allocated redevelopment funds to better serve citizens. The past 2 years, this committee has chosen to fund 3 major projects for the betterment of Carson City Parks and Recreation. The committee chose to fund a new LED signage in front of the Carson City Community Center, replacing the aging sign to provide better visibility for events within the center as well as the area. This sign is a result of the public-private partnership that was installed in October 2013. The second funding allocated by this committee was for the shade structure, lighting, and other needed improvements at Carson City Fairgrounds to partially complete needed infrastructure for the 2014 NV150 Fair that will continue to make the fairground experience even more pleasurable for the users. The third and most recent funding of $20,000 will help fund a long-needed signage outside the fairgrounds to advise public of what is available in the park and the events that are taking place. RAC has limited funding and many requests. However, they are first and foremost committed to improving our quality of life through upgrades most needed within parks and recreation and for the betterment of all citizens and future economic development. So again, congratulations to the RAC committee, the Redevelopment Authority Citizens Committee. And then we have Business of the Year. And this award is going to SignPro, local sign shop business in Carson City. Steve Reynolds, the owner of SignPro, gave the Parks and Recreation Department many hours of volunteer assistance and guidance with the new digital sign project at the community center. His assistance included advice on developing technical specifications and evaluating proposals, as well as assisting in the special use permit process. His expertise was invaluable to staff of both the Parks and Recreation Department and the Public Works Department. Mr. Reynolds gave expert testimony regarding the project to both the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission during the process. Mr. Reynolds also provided important advice and unselfishly shared his expertise in assisting our department and the Planning Department with developing an operation policy for the sign. It is no exaggeration to say that the Community Center sign project would not have been successful without his and his company's volunteer efforts. And then the last award is the one-time special recognition award. And this year we have a one-time special recognition award for Marv Texera and his two sons, Al and Matt. Noah Marvin Marv Texera. Marv was instrumental in the success of youth sports in Carson City, not only during his terms as mayor, but well before his career in local politics. He was a longtime coach in the 60s and early, that's supposed to be 70s, for the Carson City Recreation Division's youth flag football program, and from that helped to form what is still Pop Warner youth football program. He coached for Pop Warner for many years, beginning in 1972, as well as supporting the Little League and Babe Ruth baseball programs. He worked closely with Dominic Oxaby, then Parks Director, Jack Lane, Corky Smith, and others to build Governor's Field. Marv always supported all youth sports and recreation opportunities in this community and was recently honored with naming the Pony Express Pavilion to the Marv Texera Pavilion. Alan Craig Texera. Al was a longtime coach for both Pop Warner football and Babe Ruth baseball during the 80s. The Pop Warner program was in jeopardy of dissolving due to a variety of circumstances, and Al was instrumental in resurrecting the program to what is still a very successful program in Carson City. As a supervisor for the power company, Al was able to leverage his employer to do a variety of projects at Governor's Field, such as installing and repairing the outdoor field lighting and scoreboards. Whenever the Parks and Recreation Department needed assistance and equipment from the power company, Al was always there for us, no matter how difficult the circumstances, he would make it happen. As Al would always say, it is what it is. And, of course, both of these awards given to Marv and Al are posthumously. And then the final award under the special recognition award goes to Matt Texera. Matt has volunteered his time for many years to the Carson City Little League program as an unpaid umpire and chief of umpires. He was instrumental in the fundraising and planning efforts to design and construct the indoor sports facility at Governor's Field. And this facility would not be there had it not been for his tireless efforts to make this dream a reality. Matt has also been heavily involved in bringing regional and state tournaments to Governor's Field, and he continues to be involved in the success of the Carson City Little League program. Most recently, he helped expand Little League to include the older age groups when the Babe Ruth baseball program dissolved and merged with Little League. So again, you know, congratulations to Marv, Al, and Matt Texera for this special recognition award. Any questions or comments?
Right there at the very bottom, there's some names being added to the memorial wall.
But you mentioned that. You know, every year or two that we have some names inscribed on the memorial wall. Usually these are nominated by family members. They're people who have been prominent in the community, not just in recreation, but in other type of community support endeavors. And this year we're having Eugene Pasloff, who just died, what, about 3 months ago. Has it only been 3 months ago?
Yeah, 3 or 4.
Really? And submitted by his wife, Susan, and Sam Girolani, which is submitted by Mary Lawrence. And I apologize because I don't know Sam, and so I really don't have much to say about Sam. But we all know, I know that Gene Pasloff was a pillar in our community, was very active in, of course, the arts and culture scene, was heading up the creation of a charter high school for the arts, and was a former member and chair of the Carson City Cultural Commission as well, among many other things. Former educator, and then former state superintendent of schools too in Nevada. So very active. And again, I apologize because I'm not aware of, didn't know Sam, not aware of his credentials. If any of you know, we certainly can pipe in. So.
Okay, Commissioner Curtis.
Yes, I just a reminder to the public that this ceremony will be held October 21st, which is a Tuesday at 4:30 in Mills Park. I've been to several of them, and they're usually quite nice. I think one year we had snow, but otherwise I think it's been pretty fallish and pretty nice. So I encourage people to come out and just appreciate the community and what the community, members of the community, have done. And I would hope next year, if the foundation so chooses to do this again, that at least one of their members would come, if not more, to talk about the foundation and what they're doing too. Give us an update.
Yeah, normally they do. There must have been, you know, a problem or something that David didn't make it, because we've been in touch with David quite a bit. He's been, you know, very helpful, and of course he's spearheaded this whole program.
Anyone else from the commission? So then I think the main purpose of the foundation is to provide a conduit for donations to be made to the Parks and Recreation program, and they're tax deductible.
That is correct.
Now, if someone does make a donation to the foundation, did they generally put their names on that wall, or is this more for community activists, or do donors get their name on the wall too?
No, generally it's not just for donations. It's for community involvement and other means.
It's more community
but
stuff.
But there's also a fee along with the engraving of the name on the wall associated with that. I think it might be $150, but I'm not sure.
Okay, I see. Public comments on this one? No. Okay, this is why all the big guns showed up. Number 3C, possible action to recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of a new permanent location south of the Firefighters Memorial and approval of a conceptual plan for the 9/11 World Trade Center Memorial in Mills Park. Everyone, have at it.
All right, I'll kick this off. What you'll have in your staff report is a fairly detailed history of how we got from the point where Supervisor Jim Shirk was able to get a relic I-beam from the World Trade Center. And get it installed and here for the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attack. That's kind of when this started. during the process of the planning for this event, there was discussion about that being a temporary location. As it proceeded on, at the December 6, 2011 meeting, the Parks and Recreation Commission selected a site which was recommended to the Board of Supervisors, and that site at that time was the Sealy Loop. That's the area, for those of you watching at home, would be the east end of Mills Park, just north of the existing Firefighters Memorial. That was the area that was chosen as the permanent location at that time. The board agreed with the Parks and Recreation Commission and voted to approve that site. Fast forwarding ahead about a year, there was discussion. Supervisor Jim Shirk brought back to the commission around January 19th, 2012, the idea of making that into a permanent location of the memorial. And the commission at that time thought that wasn't a bad idea, so they made that recommendation to the board. During our presentation, during the Parks and Recreation Department's presentation to the Board of Supervisors about making the temporary, or the site that it is currently, from being a temporary site into the permanent site, we had Fire Chief Stacy Giomi, as well as Kenny Furlong, our sheriff, step up and say, let's maybe rethink this a little bit. And so with that, the board gave us a little bit of time to relook at looking at the existing site, possibly funding, asking for a funding plan for the memorial. That was one of the things that Supervisor Shirk was having a little difficulty getting the donations that he had hoped for. So with that, We started working with Darren Berger. He's an architect with Berger Hannifin Architects. He's donated a tremendous amount of time to help us with this and develop the new plans for the memorial. We're talking about a new location as well as an actual conceptual design. And Darren's here tonight to share with us the concepts of the new design. And we have both Sheriff Furlong and Fire Chief Stacy Giomi here with us to share with their thoughts kind of why this is a better spot and what we're going to be doing moving forward with. So with that, Darren, why don't you go ahead and go through the presentation. And
okay. Yeah. Okay, for the record, Darren Berger. I'm an architect here in Carson. I have a small little practice downtown. Thrilled to be here. I'm a Carson City native. In fact, Marv Texera coached me in football, and I did have an umpiring class from his son, Matt. And the cool thing about genetics is, it's like leaping back in time 30 years, Matt Texera and some of the nuances that he has of his dad. But anyways, just a fun little story there. And then, I got to ask another question. How can I follow up Tyler? Oh, my gosh. What a brilliant young man. And I hope this little guy is going to try to fill those shoes with the PowerPoint presentation. Well, he reminded me a little bit of myself back in the day. Yeah, not.
The other thing that I thought about Tyler is I didn't know you could get a GPA of 4.8. I didn't know it went that high. That's just amazing.
What a brilliant young man. But so bear with me through our presentation here. Vern touched on quite a bit of this, but we got involved, my firm got involved in about February of this year, again with Parks and Rec, Fire and Police Department, and were asked about, how can we improve the memorial. And when architects get asked questions like that, we do a little thing called a charrette, and we get our markers out and our fodder and kind of group up and talk to the stakeholders. And part of that process, we got together and looked at memorials across the country. There's quite a few of these. In fact, Jim Shirk secured this beam, but I guess beams from the site are scattered across the country now. Some of the questions we asked ourselves is, what's the best location for this? I know Vern touched on that. Some of the goals that we were trying to achieve is public gathering. As you look at that image, there's really not a place for people to gather around on a hardscape, and the grass is a little beaten down because of that. Place for people to sit, contemplate what had happened on that day. The idea of connecting with other memorials on the site. There's the IHOP memorial, there's also the firefighters, and then there's a veterans memorial that's there. But the IHOP memorial and the firefighters memorial exist out on that, what's the name of that island?
Sealy Loop.
On the Sealy Loop. So, I don't know if this is worthwhile here. I just want to show you guys. So here's the park. Here's the community center where we're at, swimming pool. There's the sports arena. The memorial right now is placed here. This is the Sealy Loop. The IHOP is here. That guy right there, I'm sorry, I'm bouncing all over the place here. That's the fire memorial. And we're looking. Oh, I can't help it. Yeah. So we're looking at this location right here in the park. Moving forward, so there's a zoom in of that. Again, that's the fireman's memorial on the top of the sheet. Here's a panoramic view from.
Can turn the lights off.
Oh.
Dim the lights.
Oh, lovely. Okay. Well, the. Yeah, good. So this is a image looking to the east back towards the high school. This is the entry point off of Solomon. And so we're looking at this location right here. This is the Fireman's Memorial, and you can barely see the IHOP Memorial right there. And this is what our proposed design looks like on that site. some of the goals of the design that we're trying to capture is, of course, you know, the falling of the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and Flight 93 that that crashed in Pennsylvania. And there's a couple of other side stories that I'll get into a little bit here. There's a story about a survivor tree, and that's well documented on the internet. And then also the idea of time, because this is a thing that resonates with me, is I remember that day and what I was doing. And I think everybody knows what they were doing at that moment in time when it occurred. And so time, to me, is an important element as part of this memorial. So just quickly, I want to point those out. These are the fallen towers right here. We'll get some better images here as we move forward. Right here in the center is the beam relocated. And I envision that beam being put on a pile of concrete rubble, because, you know, that's how it ended up, a pile of rubble. And I think just the starkness of that and the purity of that is something that just connects with, you know, what had happened on that day. And then the Pentagon, of course, you can see that imagery there. And then Flight 93 and this idea of time are kind of tied together, and that's the element that's part of a sundial that sticks up and casts a shadow is called a gnome. And so the Flight 93 component is in this location right here, and it's the gnome that casts the shadow, that tells the time. So other goals, of course, provide a gathering place for large groups. I think, you know, in this design, we've achieved, this is all hardscape through here. A place for contemplation. There's some benches on either side of this where you can sit and take in the beam and connect with other memorials on the site. So we're proposing that the IHOP Memorial get relocated and be on this axis that we've created through here. Kind of, again, it's on this side of the Firefighters Memorial, and we think we could give it a better home and part of what's going on here and locate it right here. And then also we're connecting via walkway with the Firefighters Memorial. So here's kind of more of a working drawing view of what's going on. Talked about the IHOP Memorial, these concrete benches right here. Here's the beam in place. Here's the gnome that'll cast a shadow. And again, this is what the vision is the shadow that gets cast from that gnome will land on a place in the concrete and somehow will document that the time window that goes from 8:45 in the morning till about 10:36 in the morning, that 2-hour window where all those events took place. Again, in the shape of some kind of airfoil wing of like an airplane to kind of capture in an abstract way Flight 93 in an airplane. So here it is in 3D. This is kind of more kind of tells a story. So you can see the fallen towers, the north and south towers, they're kind of like they've fallen over. They're at an angle. And I was envisioning that these pieces would be made out of native granite, you know, to kind of relate back to us. But they would be at an angle to represent that they've fallen over, and those are right here. And then
again, there's your steel beam sitting on a pile of rubble. And in front of that beam, as you walk up through here, there might be a plaque in front of you that talks about the event of that day and maybe where that beam came from and what it all means. And, of course, in a more literal way, it's on the shape of a pentagon to talk about, what happened there. And then, again, the gnome is right here. And you kind of pick up on a wing of a plane right here, but then there's a component piece that sticks up and would cast a shadow over in here. The story about the survivor tree, there was a tree that was the lone survivor that they found after they dug out all the rubble, and lo and behold, there's a tree, and it was still living. And so they dug that tree up, and they took it off to a nursery for several years. And I guess at the nursery, it survived a hurricane or typhoon or something. It blew over, and they had to raise it back up, and it survived that. And then they finally returned it back to Ground Zero, and it's planted in an orchard there. And it's a Kohlri pear.
Yeah.
And Vern has said that type of tree will grow in our environment. So I thought it'd be a nice way to landscape the space around the hardscape and plant those trees there to be part of that story. And then you just have some views. This is just the viewing section that shows the component pieces as you move through. There'd be a flag here about midway between our memorial and the firefighters' memorial. And then this is just looking back on axis. If you were at the IHOP memorial, looking up through the space, you would see between the two fallen towers, the grove of trees. There's the steel beam on a pile of rubble. You can see the flag in the backdrop raising up. And that's all I have for now.
So, I think one of the other things that we talked about, and of course, at this point, we're just kind of looking for your approval of the location and just the concept of this. Obviously, these are conceptual drawings, and I got to hand it to Darren. I know architecture is a lot of science and a lot of math, but there was a hell of a lot of creativity behind what he did. With very little input from us, and I'm very impressed with what he came up with, so kudos to Darren. But, we obviously are going to have to raise some funds, we've got a price tag in mind, and it's rather pricey, honestly. But during the process, we kept reaffirming with ourselves, should we scale back, or should we do this and set a vision and do it right? And I think as we push forward, we unanimously kept telling ourselves, let's not compromise on what this looks like. Let's try and set a goal and do it the right way. And so one of the things we thought about raising funds for is there were roughly 3,000 people that perished on 9/11. It was less than that, 28-something. But one of the concepts we have is selling names of individuals who perished that day, whether they be first responders, people in the tower, people on the flight, any one of those names. So if you had a particular affinity for someone, Sean, you mentioned you were a pilot at one point. Maybe you want to get the name of a pilot and you want to buy his brick or her brick. And if you wanted to buy a specific brick, we would charge you X amount of dollars. If you wanted to buy any name, it would be something less. And we thought that's on the brick, we would just have the names of the survivors. Somewhere else, we might have the names of the people who donated it. But we felt it was purer to have the names of the survivors only on those bricks and not clutter it up with, bought by Joe's Bar and Grill, because it just seemed to sort of degrade that, in our minds. And that's kind of the concept we have for raising the funds. On top of asking John and his friends for a little money, but we'll talk about that later.
Okay, so this is a possible action item, and yet, Darren, I mean, geez, that's a lot of work. Looks real good. Almost as good as Tyler. But, yeah. But, yeah, definitely a lot of creativity there. Looks good, but yeah, like we mentioned, funding's always going to be the issue. Do we have any funds dedicated for this at this point?
You know, we don't have any. When we bring it to the Board of Supervisors, we're going to ask for some funding. We're going to ask for funding. Roger and I will ask for funding when we're building our local government budget, you know, in January, February. We're going to ask for some funding there. And then we're going to try and fundraise. But when we were trying to fundraise before, we were trying to fundraise with this theory that we want the beam to be somewhere else. And we didn't have this beautiful vision that Darren created. And you know, now we have something concrete, no pun intended, to sell people and show them. And really, in my mind, the integration of the whole thing, and Darren didn't mention this, but if you stand towards the IHOP or at those Twin Towers and look back, you know, it's we sort of structured that. So you're looking down at Job's Peak. You're looking down at some of the mountains that look to the south of us. And it's really a majestic, which you can't display here, but it's really a majestic view of our valley and into Carson Valley. I think it's top-notch. So,
yeah, I think that location's perfect. Is it going to be lit at night or just dark?
Yeah.
Just the head of the bill.
Yeah. How do I answer that? It would be lovely if we could do that, but the
area is semi-lit.
We're just going to rely on the ambient light at this point.
Okay.
Instead of a brick, if you'd like to buy a light, we'd be happy to sell you a light.
Those little solar lights, like $10. I put one on Sea Hill. You can see it. Look. So, yeah, great. I know Supervisor Shirk had mentioned that, right, he would probably get some fundraising going but didn't have anything to fundraise towards. So now he has something to fundraise towards, and hopefully we can raise some funds. Commissioner McKenna.
Since you brought up lights, is there power to that area so that people can put up microphones and have events there?
Not for events. There is, because Sealy Loop is constructed the way it is, there is lighting out there, but not for events.
We do have power out there, because we have events at the Fireman's Memorial. So there's power available so that you can hook up a microphone, and you've got lights on a flagpole. So we would be able to provide power there so we could have events or just lighting or whatever we'd like to have there.
And that's really and I hate to put it this way, but it's a really good idea that we do something like that in order for the respect for the flag through our varying weather and conditions instead of somebody raising and lower proper lighting of the flag.
Other commissioner comments? Commissioner Long?
I realize it's probably just more conceptual, but the idea that brick, I just wanted to make sure that if we're going to put bricks with people's names, I think it should be everybody, regardless of whether somebody bought a brick.
Oh, yeah, we definitely would not. Okay. We would. I agree with you. We would not only put the names of people who paid.
Okay.
I mean, we would. All the names would be there. It would just give someone an opportunity to
help kind of pay for it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Correct.
Think of adopting a name.
Yeah.
The names will be there. You just
sure.
Adopt it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No. That clarifies.
Commissioner McKenna.
Just so we have a concept of what this is going to cost, do you have a concept of what this is going to cost? 100,000, 5,000, a million?
No, right now, and it is in your staff report, but it's $160,000 is currently what the estimated cost is.
So is there going to be an organization, or is the law enforcement or the fire and police going to sell this? Is the city going to do it? Is there?
Well, I think what we're going to do is we're working on finding. There are a couple of nonprofits we can approach. I'm the president of the Nevada Fire Chiefs Association. We're a 501c3. That might be the parent organization. There's the Nevada Fallen Firefighters Memorial, which is a nonprofit organization, and Roger is going to speak with Betterment or of Carson City Parks and Recreation, that foundation, and look at them being the location where people can write a donation check. But then we'll have a committee, which we already have formed, to sort of manage this process going forward.
Is there a memorial type day when you want to have this finished in 2021 before then?
Well, we'd love to have it finished on by a September 11th, whether we can make September 11th, 2015 or September 11th, 2016 or it's September 11th, 2021. I don't know, but September 11th would be the logical day in my mind to dedicate it.
Right, but I was looking more for a year, 2021, 2015, what?
Well, and I don't know till we start raising funds, I suppose, how, you know I think we'd be hard-pressed to make 2015.
2015 would be difficult, particularly if we do receive some some funding through the city, because our fiscal year starts July 1st.
Right. So I think 2016 is probably more realistic.
Probably 2016 is more realistic.
Yeah, 2016 would be 15 years, too.
Yes.
So who else? Commissioner Glenn.
So the proposal calls for the moving the IHOP memorial. What other cosmetic changes are planned, or is that pretty much it?
We would keep it simple, put a pad of concrete around it, plant some vegetation around it. Certainly we would need to engage the folks at IHOP to ask them what they'd like to see there, but just basic enhancements.
In addition to that, if you're referring to beyond the IHOP memorial, as Darren pointed out, there's a walkway that connects the 9/11 memorial with the firefighters memorial as well.
So the IHOP memorial, I haven't seen that one. What does that consist of? It's a little obelisk.
It's a small obelisk. It's located.
And Mr. Chair, that's an excellent point. The current location of it is on the north side of the firefighters memorial. It basically protrudes in the middle of a field and probably doesn't stand the respect that we have for that date. And I was extraordinarily happy that they have incorporated that's a significant piece of this entire memorial. As we all know, that the IHOP happened the week of the 10-year anniversary, and so the placement of it is just perfect.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea to incorporate it, because, right, I really didn't even know it was there. So
I think to take it even one step further and to tie it back to Tyler Torres, I read a story in, I don't remember if it was USA Today or online, but there was someone, an Eagle Scout, who was doing a project where, you know, one of the things that we struggle with is people turn flags into us all the time to burn flags. And we do. I mean, we hold them for a period of time, and then once a quarter or so, we'll go out in our burn facility and we'll burn the flags. But a great Eagle Scout project I saw from someone, in, I believe it was in Arizona, he developed a fire ring at a memorial site that they had already established to do ceremonial flag burning. And I thought, boy, what a great, after we get this built, what a great project to add somewhere around here, around the grounds, to do something like that for an Eagle Scout project. It was a cool story.
Definitely not a bad idea. Yeah, I know, speaking of scouts, boy, I went to a scout camp with my boy, and I thought we retired every flag in the whole town at that camp out. And there was a lot of smoke. Commissioner Curtis.
Thank you. I think it's of course, the whole project is good. I lived in Staten Island at the time, so I always feel kind of a personal affinity, because a lot of the guys that went over there from fire station were from Staten Island. But I'm a little concerned, though, about projects coming from here and going to the Board of Supervisors that haven't been budgeted. And I think there's going to be more. I think there's going to be more talk about that. And what I would like to see, having worked with Cassie, that's building an animal shelter, and Parks for Paws that built the dog park, is, yes, forming a 501 or using a 501(c)(3) from somewhere. And it's a lot of energy and effort, a lot more than you'll know. ask the Korean guys that did the bricks. It's a lot of work. But on the other hand, what it is, it's showing the community that you're trying your best to find the funding for it, and just not looking to see if it's in a pot somewhere.
Well, we're going to, when we come to the board, which we're planning to do on November 6th, we've got some commitments for donations already. So we're going to announce those when we come to the board. So we're not coming to the board with our hands out, with nothing in them. So we definitely appreciate that input and understand that you can't just ask for money without bringing some. So, you know, I don't know how much we'll raise, but I know that we'll raise some funds before that date. So we're going to work on just that. Thank you.
Other commissioner comments? Cassiopo.
I was going to make a motion, but I'll just say real quick. I was born in New York, and I was able to see the World Trade Center and all that, and I just took my son back there for a high school graduation gift, and we got to visit the Ground Zero site. And if you haven't been there, it's quite the impressive site. And I think being able to do something like this, if we can raise the money to do this, gets especially the kids who a lot of them weren't born yet when this happened, but this brings it closer to home. And I think if we can find a way to do it, it really does make a big statement, because I think it is impactful. I'll go like Tyler said, I don't even know if that's a good word, but as impactful as that was for those of us that saw it, a lot of kids here read about it, but, you know, didn't get to experience it. And I think being able to do something like this really gets a whole new generation, if not generations, of people aware, you know, of what we experienced.
You know, one of our local Christian, on 9/11, we did a brief ceremony at the memorial at its present location, and one of the local Christian schools had a class there that they brought to watch that and then sit in front of the beam while the teachers spoke about what happened. So it was exactly what it should have been.
So with that,
is there any commissioner comments? Is there any public comments? All right. Have at it.
That's why I'm not in charge. I move to recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of a new permanent location south of the Firefighters Memorial and approval of a conceptual plan for the 9/11 World Trade Center Memorial in Mills Park.
Is there a second?
Second.
Motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Is there any opposed? Okay, so that is done, and we're on to item 3D.
Thank you.
So thank you, gentlemen, for showing up. Good luck with fundraising. Item number 3D is for discussion only regarding landscape plans, including park streetscapes, and open space areas for the planned Schultz Ranch development.
This is where I say, go ahead, go get him, Chris. No, let me.
Yeah, just Roger's on there.
I'm gonna kick it off. Then I'm gonna hand it over to Chris, and I'm just gonna go over the staff report fairly quickly. But I'd like to introduce Chris Baker. He's a planning manager for Manhard Consulting, and he's gonna be presenting the landscape plan, which you have as Exhibit A for the planned Schultz Ranch development, which is located in South Carson City near Center Drive, Topsy Lane, and the Racetrack Road. The development plans include landscape streets, a centrally located neighborhood park, landscape linear pedestrian access corridors, and two landscape detention basins. This plan was originally brought to the Commission on April 5, 2005 for approval. The plan was approved by the Commission with the caveat that the neighborhood park be made larger. And Donna, you may remember those discussions. The original plan, the neighborhood park was 3.5 acres. The new plan is now 4.6 acres. The plan was subsequently approved by the Planning Commission and the Board of Supervisors. Schultz Ranch will eventually include 420 home sites. The landscape improvements will be developed in four phases, consistent with the completion of the development. Attached as Exhibit B is a phasing sequence that's provided by Mr. Baker. The first phase will include the first 100 lots, and then the neighborhood park will be included with the third phase of the project. The purpose of this item is to reacquaint the Commission with the project. The developer will petition the city to be included in the landscape maintenance district. That has already been done. We received a petition on October 1st, Monday. which by ordinance allows for the formation of a maintenance district within a development to fund the maintenance of the landscape improvements, including the park, of course. Individual property owners will pay an assessment for the maintenance. The Park and Recreation Department will perform the maintenance or contract it out. That's a choice that we can make. The developer must provide a petition to the council in the form of a called the LMD, Landscape Maintenance, to form the LMD, the Landscape Maintenance District, which, as mentioned, has happened October 1st. By ordinance, the Parks and Recreation Commission is one step in the review of the approval process of the petition. Therefore, that petition is going to be brought to the commission at a later date. Because of the time, it may be necessary to conduct a special meeting to address and review the petition. And again, I'd like to introduce Chris Baker, and Chris will walk you through the planned improvements for the development. So, Chris, it's all yours.
Again, for the record, Chris Baker with Manhart Consulting. I believe you guys in your staff report packets, you do have kind of all of these PDF exhibits. I'm going to just run you guys through. First of all, I'd like to thank Roger and Scott and Vern. I think all of us had about zero experience with an LMD when we started this about 6 months ago, I guess. So a lot of thoughts got into this. We essentially had to take a 424-unit subdivision, all of the landscape improvements, and design them up front, and then figure out how much they were going to cost and who was going to pay for them and how, and put that in a nice, neat legal document and submit it for review. So that's what we've been doing for the last 6 months. Really, it's all based off of these concepts, and Sandy Wendell is not here. She's actually in Kona doing the Ironman right now, but she, you'll see her name. She was very, you know, a very big part of this, you know, as far as these landscape plans, and I'm going to do my best to stumble through through her work. So this first exhibit here is what we're calling phase one in that phasing table that I'd provided, and the hatched areas are really the improvements included in that. If you bounce over to the second one, it's gonna take Vern a second here.
I didn't, a second to get there, but I'll get there.
I apologize. I just jumped off a plane, so I didn't have time to throw this into a PowerPoint, but I think we'll get the gist across. Really, in phase one is just the landscape improvements immediately adjacent to Racetrack Road, which is on the south there is a 30-foot landscape strip, and then on the north there is a 15-foot landscape strip. So as you see, on the south, there is a 8-foot meandering concrete path that runs through. On the north, there is actually no pedestrian path per se, but through our discussions, we have decided to utilize some of the DG treatments to be able to provide access to pedestrians because, you know, I think throughout the process of all this, it was a great exercise because it allowed Sandy, myself, to kind of think more like Scott and Vern and Roger on long-term. You know, yeah, you know, it was great because for planners and for landscape architects, a lot of times we design it, you know, have someone build it and then really walk away, you know, and hope 10 years down the road it looks like what we hoped it looked like. And, you know, we got to look at the other side and see, you know, what issues could arise, you know, with designs that we had provided. So what you're going to see through all these phases is, you know, a collaborative effort between, hey, long run, this is going to be better maintenance-wise. It's going to cost less for the LMD assessment. So let's just kind of work together up front so we don't have to fix this in 5 years. So, you know, you'll see a few things that are, you know, consistent with code, but maybe a little bit different than some of the stuff you see out there currently. So, again, on the south side there, we have an 8-foot meandering concrete path. Again, not too meandering because in our discussions we decided that who wants to walk twice as far to get to the same point. You know, and we do see that in places. We have actually taken turf out for the most part of this of these landscape areas. Completely turf-free here. What we've done is a mix of boulders, DG, some rock mulch, some ornamental grasses, again, deciduous trees, you know, different varying sizes of shrubs, all for maintenance and aesthetic purposes, you know, and obviously water conservation. So does anyone have any questions kind of on phase one? So what this will do is go with phase one map is actually already recorded for 100 lots. So these improvements now, when we get back in, you see the LMD in front of you guys. Once we get through the review period, you'll see when all these improvements are timed to go in. I can tell you now we're looking at, you know, probably 2015 for the improvements of phase one to go in. So.
Yeah, just to kind of orient myself, where is Clear Creek? is anywhere near phase one?
Clear Creek is, it is. I mean, is everyone familiar with the location, I guess, of Shoals Ranch before I just start spitting a bunch of stuff out here? It's obviously, Racetrack Road is immediately south of the existing racetrack that you still see out there. So on the western portion, that is Topsy Lane dropping in right there, so that's the county line. Then you have Racetrack Road picking up, which is the backbone roadway that we were just proposing to landscape immediately adjacent to. And then that runs all the way through now. And what is that? Is that Bigelow there on the other
that's
end?
That's Center Drive.
Center Drive. And then on the other side is. So the racetrack would actually sit at the northeast corner of where the improvements, yeah, it goes right in there, which is phase four. Is that
racetrack? No, I was asking about Clear Creek.
Clear Creek itself is completely north of the project.
Right, it's up in this area.
Oh, I thought I was reading. I'm reading in the staff 9 years ago, but I thought I was reading where Clear Creek was going to be treated and public access, et cetera, et cetera.
That we are adjacent to a portion of Clear Creek, but that is not till phase four, so I'll get there.
Okay, okay. When you get there, okay.
Yep.
So, Vern, where's the county line here? Does this go right up against the county line?
You're kind of right in.
Right through here?
Yep.
So is the county line.
Yes. So a lot of the off-site improvements, for example, we're doing are actually in Douglas County.
But the project's entirely in Carson City?
The project is entirely in Carson City, yes.
Do you know where that well is off of Topsy?
Yeah.
This is just to the south of that well.
Yes, I think it's in here. I think that well's in here, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, it's right in there, I believe.
Right in there. My little cursor's at.
Good? Okay. Sorry. You don't mind popping
no,
up.
I'm sorry. It kind of takes me a second or two to...
No, you're good.
To get yourself.
So phase two is pretty straightforward. As far as the number of lots proposed to be included in phase two, if you look at that chart, it is 105 lots. But the landscape improvements are very, very, very minimal. These are what we're calling, Roger had mentioned, the linear pathways. These actually have no permanent irrigation. They are really connectivity to the exterior, you know, life outside of the subdivision. So a lot of these are points where we're connecting drainage and other things. And with this, we're just putting in some bouldering, some DG. What we're doing for the path systems, and this is consistent throughout, you know, where there's not sidewalk or 8-foot concrete path like along Racetrack Road, what we're doing is we've come up with kind of a special surface. It's really type 2 base with some DG on top, and then we're doing a curbed border. So very similar to a landscape concrete curb. Yes. So this is phase three. I'll start. Really, what we have is the remainder of Racetrack Road, which is there to the northern portion of the hatched area there, which is consistent with what we showed you for phase one. And then just below that is the centralized neighborhood park, which, according to the comments previously, were asked for that to be enlarged, which we did enlarge that. Now it's about 4.5 acres. And then down on the south there is what we're calling, they're gonna serve a dual purpose. They're detention basins and kind of little pocket parks. They are quite large in size, so we figured, you know, who would want a large just detention basin, we might as well be able to kind of use a dual purpose here. So I'll show you that detail. And then off there, we do have some of those more linear paths that are connecting out to the adjacent neighborhoods. So you just go to that should be a linear park one. Or
this one?
Yes. There's a lot of info in here, so it might take a minute.
It's thinking.
Yeah. You're rushing it.
I'm rushing it.
Be patient. Be patient, Vern.
Be patient.
Vern being impatient.
Yeah, Vern being impatient.
So what you have here, as it populates, is that southern dual-purpose park. So it will serve as detention. What we've done here is proposed some turf areas. We're really seeing these as kind of smaller neighborhood, maybe some dog parks. We're going to put some trash bags and some other things. We've got, I guess the main thing, the hatching there that you see around the border is, again, that DG path with the curbing. That will serve a couple purposes. One, it'll be, a nice path for pedestrian access. It will also serve as a maintenance path if necessary. And then if you see that little kind of H-shaped feature there, kind of that road, what that is since this is a detention area, there is required access per code. So what we've done there is just provide turf block. So you won't really see that per se. It's going to kind of be built into the turf area. So you've got turf area on the west there, turf area on the northeast. And then that low-lying area is really the detention itself. What we have there is kind of a dry creek bed, boulders, native grasses, and obviously in 100-year events, that will be inundated. So the turf areas themselves shouldn't really be unless we really have a really impactful storm. So we figured we might as well utilize those, for the majority of the time. And again, you've got, variety shrubs, ornamental grasses, evergreen deciduous trees for these park areas. That little linear path concept there on the top, Vern, is the detail for all of those pedestrian access connectivity pieces to the outside community. So as you can see, we've got the path, we've got some bouldering, and again, those will not have permanent irrigation, but what we've proposed, since we're going to have water there anyway, is to provide...
Get in a little closer. There we go.
What we've proposed is to provide some native shrubs and some temporary irrigation to get them going. And, if they make it, they make it. Obviously, we're going to give, through the LMD, some realistic expectations so we don't get some complaints if, things don't grow in the desert, which we all know they don't very well. But we're going to do our best there.
Quick question. You mentioned the magic words, dog park, which is what I remember distinctly from this project, even on... though it's been 9.5 years. And I just want to comment, by the way, I'm so grateful to see you here. Mm-hmm. It's been 9.5 years since we've had any inkling that we might have an economic turnaround or a proposal like this in front of us. And so we're very happy to see you.
Well, we're excited to be here.
We want to do what we can to make sure this is successful, but on the other hand, there's a couple of things that the community is really interested in, and we have one dog park now, which is in Fuji Park, and this one would be kind of close to it in a way, but on the other side. So it might be very useful for folks.
Yeah, this actually isn't the only one. We've got both of those detention, basin park, pocket park areas. Will function as dog park areas, and for a few reasons. One, I think Parks is asked to keep them out of the main park, so we're going to provide an alternative. People are going to, if we don't let them in, but yet we don't provide somewhere else, they're going to be in there anyway. So we figure if we provide two, one on either side of the subdivision, most of the time that's going to be closer than the big park anyway. So,
but I want to interject here a little bit. These aren't going to be formal dog parks as you envision, or maybe you're thinking about like we have at Fuji Park. Really going to be dog-friendly areas where dogs can be off-leash, passive recreation. People without dogs would, of course, be welcome to use it as well. But a good place if you live in the neighborhood or if you just wanted to bring your dog from outside of the neighborhood and have him run around in a nice passive recreation area. But it won't be formalized in terms of having the bullpens and the fencing and separate small dogs and large dog areas.
Is that definite? I mean, you know, it's we can always have conversations. I understand that.
We can always have conversations.
But the,
and it doesn't
but
mean
the
that,
idea of a dog park,
yeah.
You know, just explain to people real quick, is that it is a park that is fenced so that you feel that your animal, if it's not under control, you don't have to worry about it because it's not going to get out. And so the idea of having a dog park versus a dog-friendly area is, if it's possible, you know, even if it's something that the community has to pay for, but...
You know, I'm not going to never. I'll never say never. But I mean, this could evolve or morph into some other use. But the intention now is that it's a dog-friendly area, so you don't necessarily have to have a dog to be there. You know, you can go there and throw a frisbee around and let somebody's dog intercept your frisbee, I guess. But it's really meant to be a dog-friendly area for passive recreation.
Yeah, and I'll actually just add one thing. I mean, again, the main purpose of these areas is detention. From an engineering perspective, you know, when we put fencing up, it actually constrains a lot of things. So the main point is to flow, you know, necessary waters from the street, you know, out of that low point. So, you know, maybe I misspoke by saying a dog park. Again, I think dog friendly is kind of the correct term. Moving on, again, this is kind of the big nuts and bolts here. This is the centralized park. Again, has been increased in size up to about 4.5 acres. Amenities here will include, as you can see, lots and lots of turf. Again, we kind of limited it in some of the areas through the subdivision, but, you know, in the park, it's very plentiful. You've got a soccer field there. Which can be split into, we kind of dimensioned it to be able to do 2 10-year-old AYSO games at one time, if necessary, so that we'll be able to hold leagues and other things there. You have a full-size basketball court. You do have kind of in the northeast corner there, you've got a 45 by 45 pavilion. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, plenty of tables, again, some groves of trees for plenty of shade. You do have a... we had to fight for this, by the way. We have a full plumbed bathroom.
We have a full plumbed flushing bathroom, and this is at the request of the developer.
Yeah.
If we as you know, we prefer to have porta potties and enclosures, but we basically said, well, if the developer is willing to increase the cost of the assessment to do this, we'll take a look at doing it, and we'll see how it works.
So speaking of full plumbed bathrooms, that means there's going to be water there. Mm-hmm. So I know Don has always been big on dog parks. Now, I've always been big on splash pads, and we still don't have a splash pad anywhere in Carson City. So if we're building a brand new park and we've got water there, mm-hmm. is that something we could at least talk about?
Well, you know, we've actually kind of, staff has talked about that a little bit, Sean. We have not really talked to Chris about it. And our feeling is that if we're going to, this community needs a splash park of some type, but we really believe that as staff. We're not so sure a small neighborhood park within a development is the right place to have it, because we really think because my experience with splash pads, I built one before, it was built right after I left a former community, is that that'll become a huge draw community-wide. And the parking would be, the word of the day is impactful. But the parking would be impactful on that little neighborhood. So in future planning for a splash pad, we need to have a place that's more of a community-oriented park rather than a neighborhood park. But your point's well taken, Sean.
The developer did push for that, and to us it made sense. We had water and sewer actually going through the parking lot anyway as part of the subdivision, so it seemed a little, you know, unnecessary not to have plumbing in a building that there was already water and sewer running directly underneath it. So for us, it just made sense. So again, we've got on the eastern side there, we have a full tot lot. I think tot lot doesn't really actually cover that quite so well. I think that's a full-on play structure. let's see, we've got obviously, you know, pathways connecting throughout. As you see there, kind of that little tangent shooting in there, that is, again, that turf block, because all of our park areas will kind of serve a dual function. This area here, unlike the other areas, the North Detention Park and the South Detention Park, those are their main purposes, detention. This is an extreme event, and then it would just be down there at that drainage area, which is going to be rocked anyway. So as far as the soccer field or anything, you know, during a normal event, not going to be affected at all. So any questions on the park itself?
I'd like to hear from sometime during the development. I'd like to hear from law enforcement on the restroom. We'll talk about it. There's a costing. We found out down at Riverview Park that there's a cost to have a permanent, fully plumbed restroom. Cost to the city, and it's generally patrol cars driving by at various times in the middle of the winter, that sort of thing. Tot lot, that sort of thing. Disability, access disability facilities. More and more our parks are needing to be that way. I don't know. It may or may not have that. The other question I have for staff is we need to discuss residential construction tax. Are we going to get any out of the subdivision? Is it going to go back into the subdivision? Is this restroom going to cost us versus costing them? That sort of thing.
As far as the improvements themselves, the city will not have to pay for any of them. The landscape improvements that you're seeing proposed are all going to be picked up and installed by the developer. And then as part of the LMD, once they are accepted, they will be turned over and owned by the city. The assessment itself will be paid to maintain. The LMD itself will generate tax dollars off of the 424 units that are included in the subdivision. So they will actually pay for the maintenance of those. And that's all the LMD is doing. So as far as cost to the city, the park, the backbone roadway landscaping, and the two parks, north and south, the city will actually only be on the hook for 30% of the maintenance cost. That's it. Zero upfront improvement cost.
And I might explain how that works a little bit, too. hopefully I can explain how that works. But through the LMD process, the petition, the developer has to submit what they call an allocation plan, and that's an agreed-upon plan between the city and the developer that is stipulated in an ordinance of how you allocate the improvements and who pays for what. And for instance, if you have a feature that is really primarily the benefit of that feature is almost wholly to the benefit of the people, the residents who live in that development, then that allocation is 100% to the developer. If it's a features such as a backbone road where you have landscaping that would provide trail systems or pathways that could connect to other pathways, trail systems in a larger sense of the community, or a park that is going to be open for the whole community use, and we look at an allocation of about 70-30%. And so that's all spelled out. It's included in the ordinance that was, gosh, that ordinance was enacted in about 2007. And Park and Recreation Commission had an opportunity to review that ordinance before it went to the Board of Supervisors.
So are we going to get any residential construction tax out of this that we can move to another area?
Well, I think that's still yet to be determined. That's part of the LMD that we need to have a discussion about. What has happened typically, John, in other areas, for instance, John Mankins Park, that was a park that was developed in the Silver Oak area. Most of the improvements of that park were really paid for by the developer, but they applied for offsets from residential construction tax. But really, I think, looking at Vern and Scott here, I think really probably that was a minor percentage of the coverage of the cost was through residential construction tax.
Yeah, typically what we've seen with the number of developments around town is the cost to put in these improvements far exceeds what the developer gets back in residential construction tax reimbursement. So we end up with a situation of the city will get the land, all these improvements that we will be talking about here are very significant improvements. You're talking a play structure, flush restrooms, basketball courts, picnic shelters. The money that would come back to offset the developer's costs probably wouldn't cover, would be a lot less than what they're actually going to put out of pocket in order to build this facility for the community.
Yeah, keep in mind, you probably remember that the residential construction tax is $1,000 on the living or on a dwelling unit. So, you know, it's not a whole lot of money. But I also wanted to mention, too, while we're looking at this park, is similar in size to the Ronald D. Wilson Park that we have on the north end of town, just north of Arrowhead. So if you're familiar with Ronald D. Wilson, a fairly new park. If you're not familiar with it, you can drive down. Is it Mark Street?
Markway.
Just off of a couple blocks off of north of Arrowhead, roughly about the same size park, a nice size neighborhood park. Ronald D. Wilson gets a lot of use. This park is considerably larger than John Mankins Park. Has a lot of the same amenities that John Mankins Park, and as you all know, I'm sure you're familiar how heavily used John Mankins Park is, mainly because of its location, I believe. So I would expect that this neighborhood park will be heavily used once completed.
Okay, so this neighborhood park will also be shared by the people that live south of there that are in Carson City, down the center.
This is a public park.
Okay,
it's not a Schultz Ranch park. It is a public park open to the public.
What happens if Douglas County builds houses to the west of center?
Well, I would imagine in their development agreement or through their ordinances that they would, developments likewise, would have to provide the same similar type of facilities, recreation facilities, landscaping. And so they would probably be building their own park. But nonetheless, if that does happen, we'll have two nice developments with probably equally nice landscaping and park and recreation facilities.
Yes, several comments. First of all, on the residential development tax, that's something that's near and dear to us. So I'm assuming we're going to get it. I mean, $424,000 isn't something to sneeze at. And it's going to be the most money we've seen in a while. So if it's going to be something different than that, be sure to let me know.
Donna, what I'm hearing, though, is that's going to go into this park. Is that correct?
No.
The intent on residential construction tax is to provide recreation facilities derived from the development, primarily for the neighborhood where the development takes place. Now, Carson City, years ago, enacted an ordinance that declared Carson City as a single neighborhood, which means the money can be dispersed and used in other areas. But this is still one element that we received the Landscape Maintenance District petition Monday, and it's just an item that we have to have some dialogue on yet.
Okay, it's my understanding that the Landscape Maintenance District was not to replace residential construction tax or have any relationship to it. That's so different. It's like the subdivision I live in. There is no maintenance, and there should be. It's costing the city a fortune to maintain it, but it's a separate entity by regulation, statute, and everything else. And, you know, the residential construction tax, didn't you just say with Mankins Park was used throughout the city?
No, you're essentially correct. The residential construction tax is a separate issue from the Landscape Maintenance District. The Landscape Maintenance District is set up to provide funding to maintain the parks and the landscapes that are created, not necessarily for the creation of those facilities. The plan is really through the approval process that they go through, and they go through the Planning Commission and eventually to the Board of Supervisors, the plan for parks and landscaping areas. Well, your question about John Mankins Park?
I thought you said that the money, the residential construction tax that was gathered from how many units, I forget, how many units was in those all those phases went citywide.
No.
The that money goes into pot for a residential construction tax. The developer built the park, and the developer has applied for reimbursement through residential construction tax towards the construction of that park. And as we mentioned before, the amount of money in reimbursement doesn't come close to the final cost of building that park. So the developer essentially built the park and is being reimbursed a portion of the cost through residential construction tax.
A portion.
And that is all spelled out in the development agreement that the city enters into.
Could we please maybe ask the DA to give us a summary of how this thing is supposed to work or how it can work? Because I'm interested in seeing money that comes into the city go to the city. And, you know, developers are going to be making plenty. And
well,
so the idea is that, as I understand it, residential construction tax is $1,000 per bedroom. That's the cost that those people are costing us to live there, the fire, police, et cetera, and it comes back to the city, and it's to be used for parks. But unless statutes have changed, and could be that it has.
We'll give you an update on it because we don't have the ordinance or the NRS in front of
right,
you here.
Right.
But it's not per bedroom; it's per living dwelling unit.
Okay.
So it could be a condominium unit, or it could be a house. Right. You know, whatever. It could be a duplex. In the case of duplex, it'd be two living units, and that money by NRS is to go into the neighborhood where the impact of the development is taking place. Again, Carson City passed an ordinance years ago that basically defined Carson City as one neighborhood, where larger cities like Vegas now they have multitudes of neighborhoods. And so the idea is that that helps fund the recreational facilities for that neighborhood, for that community.
Okay, let's move on. Thank you. I appreciate if we can get some more information on that. The other thing is, please be aware as this development goes out into the community, when you're talking about, you know, fairly permanent restrooms, there could be a lot of plaque. We've had people that don't want any restrooms at all. We've worked hard to talk them into having portables and to get them to put plumbing-type restrooms in. I guess good luck, and the only reason why I would say that this commission would be in favor of that would be because you have a landscaping district, and if there's going to be a lot of graffiti and a lot of damage, at least the city's not going to be paying the bill on it. But those things do cause trouble, and our friend over there would be happy to tell us about it, I'm sure. The last point I want to make is that there's comments. This is a historic area. This ranch, the Schultz Ranch, is there going to be any theme or anything that's built into the aesthetics of anything? Because what we're trying to do right now is we're trying to, you know, up the downtown area with historic significance and all that. And is there any sense of doing something there to make it a more attractive place?
At this point, we're kind of bouncing off things. So you guys know the property now, three-quarters of it is controlled by a company called Crown West, who is out of Tucson, Arizona. One-quarter is controlled by Ryder Duda, which is essentially Ryder Homes. So you have a master developer being two separate LLCs, one of which is a home builder and one of which is not. So the way we foresee this happening is probably three of the four phases will be sold off to other individual homeowners or home builders. So you'll have pretty much probably four distinct communities. And the plan is to have one overarching theme, you know, which will probably be a ranch type theme or something very similar. And we are still kind of bouncing around as far as monumentation, entry monuments, neighborhood monuments, what those are going to look like. And the way it works, I'm glad you brought this up, I was going to touch on this at the end, is the only place really to put those is in the LMD properties. So, you know, as part of that, again, these would be constructed by the individual home builders or the master developer, depending on timing, and then, you know, either turned over to the city with the property, or, you know, we'll figure out how we end up doing that. I think that's one of the things that we wanted to make sure was included, was this kind of, you know, universal theme throughout the subdivision. But the trick is how do you get four parties on track and then work with the city to figure out where to put them to make sure they're maintained properly and other things. So that's something we're kind of working through too. You know, that, and we, you know, with the LMD petition submittal, what we do have a few highlighted areas, one of which is kind of the overall theme and the monuments, and another is the construction tax. So these things are kind of negotiated documents. That's kind of the way the code's written, and, you know, I think being the first one, no one really has all the answers at this point, and we're completely aware. We're not trying to get out of anything. We're just saying we don't have the answer. Let's figure this out together. That's kind of what we're proposing at this point.
Just real quick here, yeah, going back to what Commissioner McKenna said, I know that right over Center Street in Douglas County, the landowners there is Big George Ventures, and they have every intention of putting in 300 units themselves. So, yeah, it's like throwing a big wrench in the works here, but these two, this is going to be one neighborhood. There's going to be a street that's the county line, and they're going to be the same neighborhood. So there's definitely going to be some advantage to coordinating the development with these guys. Even a potential of sharing a bigger park, I don't know. I mean, yeah, you're saying there could be two parks, but they just might be two streets apart. Or would it be more beneficial to have one big park? Because there's going to be development there, and it's going to be a development on a similar scale to this. So to have a big ranch theme here, but then these guys do a circus theme with theirs, you're going to want to talk to those guys in Douglas County.
Originally, they were kind of part of this at one point, and it actually completely kind of fell off the rails. Now there's not even an active tentative map, as I understand, on that property. So, you know, we're at the point where we've actually recorded final maps, and we could have vertical homes in a year. They can't even have a tentative map in a year. So I don't know that we can kind of sit by and wait for somebody else to drive, you know, the market for this. Being in two different counties, they're going to have two different design criteria, two different regulations. And, you know, currently we're kind of full steam ahead, you know, in contract to try and sell some of these things off. And, again, speaking for I work for Manhart Consulting, but, you know, this is something that not only is going to happen, this is something that is already happening. So, you know, when we're coming here with these landscape concepts and saying, hey, you know, this is what this park conceptually is going to look like, you can almost take the conceptual out. You know, we've gone forward and, you know, we're to the point where a lot of this stuff is already designed. So I get that there's going to be something there eventually. And, you know, I think at that point they're going to probably have to plan around us because we're going to already be built.
Yeah, I guess I kind of knew one of the principals there, the Douglas County thing, and at one point I'd seen the plans and the maps that they all had. But
it was
all
part of this.
Apparently I haven't talked to them for a while, but maybe for curiosity's sake, I'll ask what they're doing. So.
Yeah, we'd love to know, too. I mean, as far as, because we were utilizing a lot of the same drainage facilities, and now we had to completely redesign the subdivision because they kind of backed out. We were using a lot of storage on their site, engineering-wise, and now that's why the park got larger. Now we have to store some water in it.
You know, Sean, I think what you said made a lot of mistakes, makes a lot of sense. Freudian slip there. You know, I mean, it really does, because if he can do, you know, more of a regional planning, then both communities are better off. In fact, one time we even talked about the possibility of having the recreation center being located in South Carson, because we're anticipating growth coming up from north Douglas County. And kind of visualize the same thing. Can you have a facility that kind of spans county lines? The problem is what Chris said is that, and what Donna said, we're happy to have some development happening in this community that shows that, you know, that the economy is picking up. We certainly don't want to slow them down by making their development contingent upon an unknown development coming into North Douglas County. So, you know, that would not be fair to the developer or, you know, to that private concern.
Yeah, that makes sense there, Roger. I'm gonna shoot out an email tonight and see where those guys are, because I haven't heard for a while. But at one point, The guy showed me plans and maps and everything else. So you guys are full steam ahead, and right, all of us want to encourage that. Anyway, yeah, I just at some point there will be something across the street.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, I think originally they were kind of very cohesive, and they were kind of planned together. Like I said, sharing engineering drainage facilities and other stuff, and kind of taking a universal theme across. But, you know, if the ship stops on one and the other one's kind of full steam ahead, albeit 9 years later, you know. So you never know. Maybe the same developer could pick up that property too and kind of incorporate it in. That'd be great. So, if you don't, any other questions on the park before we move forward?
Sorry.
So that finalizes phase three. And so you know the timing of phase three. The park, all of this is actually governed by an existing development agreement that is, you know, in place now, which kind of talks about when the timing of maps and when the timing of improvements need to be done. So you know the park itself actually needs to be built with the 210th residential unit. So this isn't something that we can just kind of push off. So what that ends up happening is that's, we say phase three, but that's only five residential units into phase three. So that's something that's going to be built, you know, before halfway of the subdivision being done. So, and last but not least is phase four. What we have there is, again, on the northern boundary, that is where we interface with Clear Creek. We have kind of two portions here. We have the north detention basin slash park area, and then we also have the kind of connective path. What that is there's a gas line that runs right through there. There's a 30-foot easement that we can't move. We can't relocate. So what we've done is kind of plan around it. It's going to be used as a divider for the neighborhoods. Plus, we've got kind of a – it gives us the opportunity to do a, you know, a connectivity path to that North Park and to that Clear Creek area. If you want to go to the next one, you're good.
I know this isn't a probably even a practical consideration, but I look back at San Francisco with their gas line problem, and you have houses on both sides of this gas line. Is that going to be something we need to worry about as a city?
Everything that we've submitted has also been submitted and approved to the gas company. We actually were told we couldn't do a lot of things that we wanted to do.
Okay.
Trees, for example. We couldn't put trees in this area. So what you see here is there was a few things. One, they didn't really want a paved access path over their gas line because they do run through there quarterly. And if they need to do any repairs or anything, they didn't want to have to rip up concrete to do it. That kind of drove this unique, actually, Sandy came up with it. She's used it in parking lots in Genoa and other places, this unique surface, which is, again, it's a type 2 base, but type 2 base doesn't look all that great. So she's proposed to top it with a DG. So it'll look like a DG trail, but it'll be heavy enough to where it won't erode if vehicles are constantly going on it. And then to keep it in place, again, we've kind of utilized that that curbing to keep all of that material in place. So this will be, you know, 10-foot path there for vehicular access for the gas company. That'll also function as the pedestrian access path. And then we've kind of keeping the same thing. We will have irrigation in here. So we'll have permanent shrubs. You know, we're going to kind of work with the gas company to see what we can get in there. They don't want any deep-rooted trees, so we're going to kind of negotiate back and forth and give them a plant list and see what we can actually come up with. So again, boulders, DG, ornamental grasses, you know, lots of shrubs. You'll see there, kind of on the left side on the top one, that's actually sidewalk connectivity to that gas line easement, and then there will be a gate there. So, you know, as far as pedestrian access will be, you know, pretty easy, but we don't want anyone taking ATVs or anything through there. So,
yeah, would you also check with the fire department, see if there's any specialized equipment that might be needed? And it might be 40 years down the road, but it's just...
Well,
One of the other things, just real quick, just I know we've been kind of working our way around the development, but as this trail goes to the south and connects into the road right here, this is the main backbone road. You're able to go down here and connect across the street, and you're into the park. So it makes a real nice being able to connect through that whole neighborhood, that northeast section of the neighborhood. You connect over to the neighborhood to the west. They feed in through different cul-de-sacs and different road connections, and so it really becomes a nice linear spine for people to use as a pedestrian connectivity down to the park. So that's really a nice feature of this thing, too.
Now what Vern's bringing up is, again, that detention park area in the north. It's a little bit different than the one in the south. There's not really, not as much turf here. There's not really any turf, to be honest with you. What we have, this is going to retain a little bit more water. What we have is kind of a two detention system here. And then, as you can see, we have a path that connects to that gas line path. It'll be consistent, same material. It'll come all the way down around the whole park and drop into the sidewalk network and into the street there. So that'll dual function. It'll help the pedestrians get around. And then just that far western, southwestern portion will utilize for access for maintenance for the detention. So you'll have that little spine that pops off on the north and the south sides, which are, again, that turf block material. The bottom of the basin here will be ornamental grass across the board. Again, this will be a dog-friendly area. Portions of that, you know, again, will get inundated with water, very similar to the south detention basin. But as far as, you know, it's pretty much a flat bottom. It's a good-sized park, so we figured we might as well, since we don't get very much rain, we might as well utilize what we can while we can. Sandra's actually come up with, in the entry there, is what she's calling a butterfly park. So you'll get a lot of butterfly bushes, a lot of things to attract bees and other insects. You know, obviously not in an attempt to be a nuisance, but, you know, obviously an attempt to kind of get some diversity in the area, you know, utilize some of the stuff that actually grows here and does well. She's proposed some mounding and other stuff there, and obviously some evergreen and deciduous trees. As you see, it's kind of ringed with shrubs. There is one outlet there, kind of halfway through. So that, right there's the that's the detention outlet. So that's the low point there that'll kind of flow out into that Clear Creek area, which is that area there. We're proposing a split rail fence along that. Nothing, you know, too overwhelming as far as, since we do have a nice visual area there, we don't want to block it off with kind of a dog-eared fence or anything. We've talked about lining the split rail, using something a little bit higher than, say, your standard 36, maybe going to a 42 or a 48, and then putting maybe some wire mesh or something on it so we can keep dogs in if people are going to utilize that as a dog-friendly area.
On the north there, how does that interface, or is there an interface with the Clear Creek? Is there a FEMA flood zone there?
Yeah, we've got, you see the line right there? That's actually, the flood zone is on the other side. Okay. So we stay out of it, yeah.
So the park it was out of it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. No.
He thought you were going to get away.
For the record, Kenny Furlong, the sheriff.
Now I'm on your good side. I think that there's lots of impact that's worthy of discussion. Most of it is going to be that I would restrict my comments to is to that public access areas. A frequent comment that we receive is area lighting in those subdivisions. People for along the streets, the further away from the township areas, the less lighting we have, and many people believe that area, those street lights, do have an impact on crime, and I would suggest that Roger and I could both sit here all day long and talk to you about, call it the low level vandalism that will occur in those areas, primarily, especially around park areas. We deal with that virtually every single day here. I would suspect that will taper off with time, and I would compare this to the park up on the west side,
Mankins
Park. We dedicated a lot of resources to a lot of vandalism to that park, and I sit here, I thank God that the housing is going in right along that park, because I think that will, in and of itself, the closer you bring the families into the park, the lower the vandalism will be. But as these parks pull up and the housing's not there, it's certainly going to task us. I would make a final comment, and this probably should be more towards with the Board of Supervisors. You increase an area at an extreme end of Carson by as much as 1,000 people, adult and children alike, because this is stick dwelling. It's going to have an impact on law enforcement because it is going to pull resources, and we can calculate that ability not just by our community crime rate, but other factors as well, and determine what additional workload we are going to have that's going to pull resources to the extreme south end of Carson. And quite possibly, Mr. McKenna, speak very closely with Douglas County on how we can share some resources down in there. This is going to be a reach. This is not an unforeseeable reach for law enforcement. We've anticipated this along the path, and in fact, Roger and I have had some discussions about not just the housing areas of the extreme sides of town, but the areas of town that don't have housing and how we're going to deal with those as well down the road, because they are challenges. And we are stretching our resources not by necessarily incident rate, because we were doing very well as a community, but by geographic rate. We're pushing further and further out. And the last comment I would make, and this one I make very, very strongly, I know John has ridden with me at nighttime. Friday night I had a young boy from the Ukraine do a ride-along with me, and I took him home about 2 o'clock in the morning. One of the comments that he made was he was astonished at the number of people who are walking their dogs late at night, at all hours of the night in this community. And they do that because they feel safe. And along these arteries that you have described, those are the places where people will walk their dogs in the middle of the night or take a walk. And that's widespread throughout town. It's surprising to get out there at 2 or 3 in the morning and see folks walking, enjoying themselves, and taking their dogs. So lighting should not be taken lightly. It does provide a level of comfort. And when you're in an area that is exclusively residential, I suspect you will have an awful lot of that.
I've got to follow up on that. It's not uncommon to see new neighborhood parks in the early stages receive a lot of vandalism because what Kenny said, that there aren't the houses built up across from it. And I think we're going to see at John Mankins Park now that those houses are being built across the street, and you have eyes across the street, that's going to, you know, reduce some of the vandalism. The other thing about John Mankins is that
it doesn't come over to College Parkway. There's a empty field in between, so patrol or anybody else driving up College Parkway doesn't see what's going on in that park. I like the idea of the concept here of when this park is triggered to be built, because there's going to be automatically lots, not necessarily maybe houses, but there will be lots and activity and construction going on nearby it. So it may not be as heavily vandalized as John Mankins was.
This may not be parks related, but it's something we probably need to discuss, is the impact also on the Colony and Stewart Indian School that's in between Carson City and this particular development.
I would say that that's going to be a social adjustment for some of the folks that are going to ultimately buy homes down there, because they're crossing a jurisdictional boundary.
Okay. Thanks for the input. Any other public comments? All right, so before we wrap this one up, I have to make one last plug for Splash Park, because I agree with you. I agree with you, it should be in place, but I saw at least 20-plus parking spots in that plan. So we could at least ask the developer if that was something they can. I can't think of many other parks that have that much parking that we currently have, other than Mills, Centennial, and Edmonds. So anyway, something that we could at least ask about. With that said, anything else on this item? Okay, that means we can move on to item 3E. This is another possible action item to consider whether the city should move forward with developing an ordinance that bans smoking in city parks. So I can lead into that one a little bit. We brought this up in the August meeting and discussed it slightly and decided we put it as possible action in October, give the community a chance to maybe show up, which it looks like they didn't. So I don't know what that means. Either they didn't know or they didn't care. So, Roger, I'll let you see what you need to say on that.
Photograph in your packet of the historic Schultz Ranch, kind of going back down to what you were talking about being a historic area. I think that's an interesting comment. Okay, I found my place here. The Park and Recreation Commission, as Sean mentioned, has asked staff to bring forward a discussion as to whether there should be consideration to develop an ordinance that bans smoking in city parks. This topic came before the commission before, most recently in 2010. I think even back before then, probably around 2006, 2005. And so a staff report regarding that that date is listed as Exhibit A. Some of the support that you find in banning smoking in parks usually includes at least one of the following main reasons. Number one, that parks should promote healthy lifestyles and smoking is unhealthy. Smoking in parks infringes on the enjoyment of non-smokers and represents a health risk to all park users. Smoking in parks sets a bad example for youth. Smoking in parks causes increased costs in addressing the resulting litter associated with smoking, and smoking can result in fires, especially in our undeveloped or natural parks. And, of course, staff agrees that all those are a concern, legitimate concern about smoking in parks. However, our biggest concern has always been when it comes to enacting an ordinance that prohibits smoking in a park has been our ability, not just our ability as a park and recreation department, but ability of the sheriff's department also to enforce that ordinance. When you write an ordinance, after you write an ordinance that prohibits or governs something, then you are really expected to enforce that ordinance. And as you know, we have one park ranger that covers, at the moment, not only all of our parks, but covers our open space areas too. That individual is spread rather thinly, and I'll let Kenny later on talk a little bit about how an ordinance like this may impact his operations. many cities across the country have enacted smoking bans in their city parks. Some cities have been very successful with this. Other cities not so successful. Came to our attention here a couple of years ago that Seattle, Washington actually reversed their ban. I'm not sure what the reason for that was. I don't know if there was some kind of a court case involved in it. But I suspect that probably one of the problems that they encountered was the enforcement of smoking in parks. Of course, that's a city like Seattle. Seattle has their own park police department, you know, and don't have to rely upon a sheriff's office or a police department to enforce the rules for them. I can tell you that we received very little, and I'm kind of speaking when I say we, I'm speaking mainly for Scott and I, very rarely do we receive any complaints about smoking in parks. Now, what we did after the 2010 meeting, we decided instead of having an ordinance that would prohibit smoking, that we would try to go the voluntary compliance route. And if you remember, we had these signs put up around our playground areas in our parks. Some of them have been stolen. Yeah, I don't know why it looks like an attractive sign, but it says, please don't smoke here. Young lungs are working in Carson City Parks and Recreation Department. I'll tell you, prominently there's one at the Fuji Park playground there. And I think by and large, it's been very successful in achieving voluntary compliance not to smoke around the playground area, particularly where children are playing. So I've listed several options, and then I'll let our other speakers talk. But the options that I've listed is, there's always the option to take no action. Second one is consider an approach that would ban smoking from parks and recreation facilities. Simple. Really simple in concept. Consider an approach that would designate where smoking is prohibited in parks and recreation facilities. And conversely, consider an approach that would designate areas in parks and recreation facilities where smoking is allowed. Just recently, a few months ago, about a month ago, I took a little trip up to Montana to visit my kids and stopped in, I think it was American Falls, Idaho. They had a really nice park there with a nice pond, an amphitheater over the pond. He got up early in the morning, took the dog for a walk, and it was really kind of humorous in a way. They had a beautiful park, big parking lot in front of the amphitheater and the pond. And then over on the far end of the parking lot, I saw this little picnic table with a trash can next to it and a sign right out in the parking lot, really kind of barren. I thought, well, what is that all about? So I walked over there, and it had designated smoking area. And I thought, how attractive is that to have somebody go sit out in a hot parking lot, no shade, you know, and that's your designated smoking area? I was very skeptical how often that was used as a designated smoking area. So, but the point I'm trying to make is a lot of cities have tried a lot of different approaches towards smoking or banning smoking in their parks. So another option would be to designate areas in the park and recreation facilities where smoking is allowed. And then I think there's really a fifth option that I didn't enumerate in the staff report that I think my personal opinion is one that I think has the most merit given our situation in Carson City, and that is to expand the voluntary compliance with signage. In other words, instead of just having this maybe in the play lot areas, playground areas, maybe have a sign to some effect that is in the entrance into the park that ask for consideration, voluntary compliance not to park. You could simply say, be considerate to others, please don't smoke in our park. Now, we really can't enforce that, but it's the opportunity of trying to get people to voluntarily comply and to be considerate of others and be concerned about the health issues of smoking and the environment that they're in. And I guess with that, I'll kind of turn it over because I know the sheriff has some words he'd like to say or some comments he'd like to make, and then we can turn over to comments from the commission.
For the record, Sheriff Furlong, virtually cannot agree more with what Roger has presented. Roger and I have talked about this over the years, not just today, and I think a few years ago I've been here with this commission. I would really discourage any recommendation to create an ordinance that is, number one, not enforceable by any means. Less put in an army of folks out there to go through the crowds. How is it possible? And then it becomes discriminatory. Who are you going to enforce it against? The kids out on the skate park or the adults out in the crowd? As Roger and I have been talking about it, I can't help but visualize the most significant event that we hold in this park, which is our 4th of July celebrations, where several thousands of people are going to be out in that park. There surely is no expectation that an enforcement officer, be it a park ranger or a police officer, is going to go through that crowd and remove somebody from our 4th of July celebrations because their family is planted and picnicking in the middle of the park waiting for the fireworks and somebody has a cigarette. It is not enforceable. It will not work to create an ordinance that says you cannot smoke in a park. Is a person in violation if they're alone in the park? At a far away, other than the center of town? And is law enforcement going to send patrol units to that? Because, yes, we do get calls to all of the parks at all hours. Secondly, why I strongly support Roger is, and I'll say it humorously, I was not aware that as we kicked off the state, call it the 150th fair at Fuji Park, that pseudo-voluntary ban was in place. But there were two designated areas. And people were using them. We have an advantage. One of the strengths in Carson City is the cooperative side. Why do I have to create an ordinance to get cooperation? Why do I have to threaten our public? Why do I have to threaten our families with an ordinance? When that voluntary cooperation, as we saw, and call the Fuji a great test run, call these children's areas a great test run, you tend to get more voluntary compliance than you expected. And people use them. But I cannot state it enough. To create an ordinance is not going to entail the sheriff's office to go through a park and start citing people for smoking. It just does not have the capability to do that. And the first time you cite one and don't cite the other, you really run into some real issues.
If I could make one other comment, too. The other thing we have to try to determine is the unintended consequences of a ban and ordinance of this nature. And I'll give you a very specific example. I'm sure you've all seen the high school students come across from the high school over to Mills Park in front of the Wanganeema House area there and smoke. And they do that because their smoking is banned on the school grounds. And so these kids, I mean, I don't think kids ought to be smoking, but some kids are going to smoke. And so they go over there and smoke. Well, if we had a ban and didn't allow smoking in Mills Park, where are those kids going to go? They're going to probably go over to the apartment complex next door and hang out in front of that area, possibly down to the CVS pharmacy in that parking lot, or across the street to the church. And, you know, all you're doing then is you're just moving that problem around. You're moving it from the park to other private property ownership. And I don't think that would necessarily be a neighborly act to our private, you know, our private properties next to our park. So I think we have to be very mindful of the unintended consequences of this type of an enactment to ban smoking from parks.
And I will add on to Roger about that, the Brick House area, if you will, across from the high school. The high school is taking, or the school district, is taking some considerable steps to keep the children from call them young adults, from leaving the school campus in the middle of the day. And in fact, the reality of it is we have seen over the years fewer and fewer children going into that park or at the Brick House because they have phased a process of, no, you won't leave the campus in the middle of the day. That still leaves the beginning and the end. But by and large, we're seeing fewer and fewer problems along that Solomon Street.
Well, with that said, yeah, I've taken some notes because this one's one that I brought up, and it's kind of one that's personal to me. I brought this up because there was an article in the NRPA magazine about how Houston enacted a smoking ban at their parks and how many cities in Texas have smoking bans and how it's becoming the norm to have smoking bans across the country. So to say it's not enforceable, it is in all these other cities. They're not sending out armies of folks to write citations, but all of these cities are doing this because they're proactive. You brought up Seattle dropped their smoking ban. I can tell you exactly why. It's because they're the epicenter of marijuana smoking. And every 411, they have a huge, huge smoke-off in their parks there. So instead of showing up and writing citations to thousands of people there, they figured, let's just kind of walk away from this. But to say that it didn't work and whatever, Seattle's kind of a unique situation. I can tell you as a physician, the government now requires me to ask every patient that walks in the door if they smoke or not. It's required because it's a huge health concern, huge. As a podiatrist, I'm required to tell patients that smoke to quit smoking. Required. I have to document that. Why aren't we as a community going to set an example? I just don't understand why we would. This shouldn't even be an issue. There's nobody anywhere that can show me that smoking's a good thing. It's not. And we're not asking for an army of folks to come out and write citations. We're saying let's be an example here. Let's be proactive rather than reactive. There's other laws that could be voluntary, like leash laws. We could make those voluntary. We could make litter laws voluntary. We could make speed limits voluntary. But we don't because we know there's an effect to those. 4th of July you brought up. I wouldn't expect thousands of deputies to be there writing citations, but I can tell you that I have not enjoyed the fireworks at our home park because my wife's very susceptible to cigarette smoke. Last time we went, she had a massive breakout, and we haven't been since. We're not asking for deputies to show up in mass to write citations. We're simply saying let's be an example to the community and do what we should do, and we bring up Smoker's Corner. It might move somewhere, correct, but as a community, we're going to provide a place for our kids to smoke? That's just wrong. That's just wrong. It's a public health issue. It's the way things are going. We need to be proactive and not reactive as a community. And other comments, commissioners? Commissioner Long.
So I think probably we all agree that all laws have some degree of leniency or whether they're actually enforced or not. So one question, I think all parks do have an ordinance against no alcohol. How do you typically handle that scenario for example, I'm sure the 4th of July, plenty of people have alcohol in the park. So how do you handle that
scenario? That's a real good point. City-sanctioned events, we have alcohol in the parks all the time. So I won't. And this is along that same path. I cannot distinguish between you and you as to who I'm going to enforce against and who I'm not. Many of our events in our parks have alcohol. Many of our families have alcohol. It's not prohibited. I think the glass containers is prohibited. What I'm telling you is if you create an ordinance, you're creating a law. And if you create a law, there must be the ability to enforce it. And there is no ability. I'm sorry. There is no ability in this town to put officers in the parks to start looking for smokers.
I would just counter again. I don't think anybody's asking to put officers in parks to look for smokers. We're not looking for glass bottles. We're not looking for leash law violations. We're not looking for litterers. And those are all laws. It's a matter of having an ordinance to set an example for the community.
Well, you know, I agree with you, and I don't think anybody here is defending smoking and saying that smoking is a healthy activity. Sean, I know where you're coming from on this. And maybe the way we set that example is to try to increase our voluntary compliance. And you know, we all know that there's warning labels on cigarettes, right, that say caution, smoking is dangerous to your health. And so we're all pretty skeptical about how effective that is, because you got somebody buying it who's smoking it and reading the label. But by having, you know, maybe asking for voluntary compliance, that is setting an example. That's asking our citizens to set the example, and not to have the law enforcement or the local government set the example for them. I personally think that just because communities are enacting ordinances doesn't mean it's successful. You know, it doesn't mean that that's been successful just because they've enacted the ordinance.
Can I take it to a parallel? Years ago, there was discussion in this town about creating an ordinance for gang activities, to discourage gang activities in the parks. The parks are an instrumental piece of our town. The positive things that are going on in those parks clearly outweighs anything. John, everyone in this room knows I probably went out and took a smoke break tonight. The park, the physical activity far outweighs. We didn't enact an ordinance to keep the gang members out. We attacked the gang members. We don't need an ordinance to keep the smokers out. We need to do exactly as Sean has described, and it's to keep up that program, that anti-smoking program. Our health department has a very effective program, right, John? Very active program. Every doctor in this town is doing the exact same thing. You walk into the office, you might as well sign off on that first question, and I strongly agree with it. The health concerns are up front all the way across this country. I don't want to sound antagonistic to you folks. I don't want to do that. It's just that we don't have officers to do it, and we don't have park rangers to do it.
On the health department program, it's grant-funded, and it's a voluntary program?
I believe you are correct. Both John and I sit on the health board. It's a very, very active program. I think that this community has come a long ways. Our restaurants are more pleasant to sit in today. Many of the areas around town are more pleasant to sit in today. Many of the areas are safer, because we don't allow certain things to take place. But to create an ordinance that does not have the ability, it becomes a sense, it feels good on a piece of paper. Feels good. What am I going to do, Sheriff Furlong, when in the middle of Mills Park, somebody's smoking marijuana for medicinal purposes? The ordinance feels good. The reality doesn't work. The ordinance feels good. And so I urge very strongly, I love this path. I'm a smoker. I complied. Not because I was in uniform, but because it was the right thing to do. And it's going on already in different areas of our parks, and it can be enhanced. It can be enhanced to make it a much more healthier environment. As you said, because our community wants this.
Okay, I guess I'd like to hear what other commissioners say before we make a motion of any type. Commissioner Curtis.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on, you know, Sean's situation. So he's got his wife in Mills Park, and her 4th of July is being run by, let's say, some overly large person with a black beard who's smoking. I mean, so it's not that everybody wants to come up to this person, maybe, and say, put your cigarette out. On the other hand, her experience is being ruined. So what's the answer? If you can have signs that discourage smoking around the whole park, I mean, can you declare that Carson City is a park? Just like you did with, you know, we're a neighborhood. Have one sign and it covers everything. I guess my questions are then, okay, let's get to the practical side of it. If you can't bring in an army, and nobody suggesting that you should or could, then how do we deal with these situations that might discourage people to say, okay, fine, I didn't know. You know, I don't want to run a deal. You know, I'll put it out. Who knows?
And I think Donna kind of brings up a point here. No one's asking for an army. No one wants people running around writing citations. But if it is an ordinance, it at least gives a citizen the opportunity to say, hey, something. Hey, that's not appropriate here. If it's voluntary, they're just going to say, too bad for you. Now, hopefully it wouldn't escalate into more than that, but it gives us citizens the opportunity to tell someone to put that smoke out. Now, yeah, you're a smoker. For the most part, you're considerate. But there's smokers that aren't considerate, and they ruin the experience for people that want to be in the park and enjoy the park. Commissioner Long brought up a good point about alcohol, which I guess is glass containers. So should we throw that ordinance out? Just make it voluntary. Throw out the litter laws, make that voluntary. You don't have guys going out as an army looking for litterers. You just don't. But if it happens, and you happen to be there, there's an ordinance against it. And that's the point with smoking. No one's going to be out running around. It's just not going to be an overly huge priority to enforce, just like all of these other things aren't. But it gives even citizens an opportunity to ask someone to put it out. Whereas if that's not there, there's no recourse. And frankly, it's a health concern. So, Mr. Bailey, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As far as I used to be a smoker, and it took, it's salt and pepper. It's more rabbinical looking. It's a little salt and pepper kind of thing.
It used to be bigger, too.
And I have tattoos, but I can't tell you where. I'm not for it. I think they're even using nicotine to fight Ebola now. I don't know. It's really something. It's a drug, and it's an addictive one. I smoked, gosh, I think I've been off it now about a dozen years. And I was picking up cigarette butts over at the pond today, and I'm going like, well, those poor souls, but you want to know something? It's part of their experience, too. It's part of what they like to do. Old man of the sea. They enjoy sitting back with a rod, reel, going fishing with a cigar or a cigarette in their mouth. And I think, to me, there's been enough bloody freedoms taken away, and I can see the small. How old do you have to be, Kenny, to buy a pack of cigarettes? 21? All right, so there's already laws. 18. So you can go fight in a war and you can smoke. Okay, so maybe that's what it is. I'm not for it. I'd say there might be instances in some situations in parks, like indoors, that are probably, it's already governed. That's already got a law on it. Okay, outdoors, I don't see it working, and I think it's a personal thing. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Commissioner Curtis.
Mr. Bailey, can you see having a designated area around the pond where people smoke?
No, I think the whole pond's a designated area to smoke. It's open. It's open air. There's Clear Creek that is... the Clear Creek corridor, I'll call it, I don't know if there's ever no wind there that blows the smoke. You're right up against Highway 395. If that doesn't do something for your lungs, I don't think cigarettes are going to do anything worse for it, although it's all heading east, so that's good. Someone else can cough and choke and whatever, but as far as I see... it's almost part of the sport. So.
Does it make sense? I'm just kind of brainstorming ideas here, throw it out. It might be a ridiculous idea. But does it make sense to look at the model that
Sheriff Furlong referred to at Fuji Park. And while you're not necessarily banning smoking in the park, but you do designate a smoking area. Now, I think that I don't think all parks could necessarily function that way because you have some really small parks, but maybe the larger parks you designate a smoking area, ask for voluntary compliance not to smoke except in those designated areas. Again, it's voluntary, it's compliance. There is no enforcement by the law or, you know, the strength of the law behind it. But would that get the message across that, hey, if you do want to smoke, this is the area where you should go smoke, leave the rest of the park smokeless on a voluntary basis? I mean, does that make any sense?
So, yeah, I like the fact that Roger's brainstorming ideas here, but yeah, Mr. Bailey just said that wouldn't make sense because it's part of the sport to smoke.
That's a little bit different area. I mean, that's a fishing area. I'm talking more in a park location rather than, you know, a specific spot.
And it's a reasonable thought, I guess. And, you know, I respect people. I don't care what people do with their lives. It is a personal decision. But I do care if I'm sitting at Bailey's Pond with my two sons and someone 20 feet up lights up and it's blowing right into me and my sons. That impedes my ability to enjoy the pond. It impedes my ability to go to the park, and it happens. It just does. So, again, I see this as something that's going to happen. When I moved to Nevada, you could smoke in restaurants, which that's changed. Back in the day, there was ads of doctors recommending cigarettes. I mean, that's changed. There will come a point where the federal government, mark my words, says you either do this or we're going to dock you. It happened with blood alcohol levels. That you wouldn't get highway funds if you didn't drop your blood alcohol level to 0.08. It's just going to happen. So we can sit here and say it's not going to happen, but it will. I just would rather be a proactive community than reactive, because 10, 20 years from now, it'll just be the norm. Because when you impede other people's ability to enjoy the parks, it's just going to happen, in my opinion. But I guess we'll see if that happens or not. Commissioner Glenn?
Yeah, I think that if there's a way to solve a problem without passing an ordinance or passing a law, it should be sought out. And I do think that you can pass a law, you can pass an ordinance, people are still going to smoke, people are going to still smoke at the parks. I also think that if you create areas which you designate as non-smoking and discourage smoking, people do try to abide by the community rule, whether it's a law or it's not a law. I know at the little, I don't know if it's a law at the Little League fields if you can or can't smoke, but I do know we put up signs on every field, don't smoke here, lungs at play, and people don't smoke at the field. They may go smoke in the parking lot, and they may go 50 or 100 yards away, and if someone does light up, someone says something, and you've got the backing of community support because you have that designated area or you have that discouragement to basically say, you know, this is an inappropriate behavior at this specific place. I think that if we entertain the idea of designating areas at various locations to see if that has an impact, I think we should give that a try. I don't always think passing a law or an ordinance, if you don't have to, is going to be the right path. And then if there's still a serious problem with, you know, people being able to enjoy the parks after we've made that you know, attempt to do it without passing a law, maybe that should be revisited at that time. I wasn't even aware that, I mean, I'm glad this got brought up, because I honestly wasn't even aware that it was such a big problem that, you know, you walk to a park, and if someone's smoking, and if you tell someone, hey, this is bothering me, you mind putting it out, or mind going in another direction to smoke? I've never hesitated to ask people, you know, in public, if their smoking's bothered me, to ask them to put it out or move somewhere else. And most people even ask you if it bothers you. So I do think the route of, you know, exploring the idea of designating areas at the various parks could be a good one.
Mr. Bailey.
Thank you, Chairman. I got a deal for you. Give me another acre at the pond, and then you can partition 1 acre for the non-smoking part. How's that?
I think, I mean, you know, in fairness, those signs right there, I think, have done some good. And the drawback to those signs, the limitation to the signs was kind of brought up here. You're going to have to put them all, in order for it to be effective in the park in general, you're talking hundreds, thousands of signs. I mean, suddenly the park could look like a sign place, but where those have been, it seems to have worked. But yeah, the drawback of the voluntary one is you'd have to have these signs everywhere. And I guess the benefit I see with an ordinance is not that we're out writing citations, but once someone is aware that it's an ordinance and they're told about it once, they're reminded of it by a ranger or a deputy or a citizen, hopefully they'd be discouraged. They wouldn't need a sign. I don't want anyone to get a ticket for smoking in the park, but once they know that it's not acceptable, hopefully they wouldn't. Whereas if we were relying on signs, I don't know. It's worked where they've been, but it's been such a little confined area. So
if you have a sign, if you have an ordinance banning smoking, you're going to have a sign that's going to, that informs the people that this, you know, is a non-smoking area, and then you have to cite the CCMC on it, the number, the code. So you're going to have signs anyways. So I agree with you. The last thing I want to see is sign pollution in our parks. And I think you just sort of try to pick, you know, the most appropriate places. Probably most parks have kind of a general entrance to them. You can put them in that area, put them around the playgrounds. But, yeah, I agree with your concerns completely. We don't want to have too many signs, you know, in our parks. I mean, Scott Fehrenbrook's about the only one that likes signs in our parks, I guess, here. But,
could I ask, are there maybe a couple of parks we could try? Mills and Fuji, because they're pretty well known, and see what happens in terms of complaints from people. And I don't know if you get complaints now even about smoking. I think you said you really don't. But, you know, maybe you'll start getting comments from people, thank you for the signs.
The fact that we're not getting complaints doesn't mean that people aren't complaining or that people aren't, you know, being inconvenienced by smoking. You know, that I'm certainly not saying we don't get complaints, but that doesn't mean that people out there aren't being inconvenienced by other people's smoking behavior. And when you say, can you try, I mean, are you talking about can you try having designated areas in those parks, or can you try to have a ban in those areas? We really can't have a ban unless we have an ordinance.
We haven't decided, I don't think.
Well, designated. Well, I'm just talking about some kind of pilot project, but doesn't cost a lot of money and a lot of effort, but maybe gets at the problem. Let's see what the problems are at the parks. And, you know, we saw what happened at Fuji. There's an example there already. And I didn't see anybody smoking. I don't know if you did, John. But, oh, there was one guy, I think. There was one guy in front of me that.
Is he big with a beard?
I think it was kind of grayish. But okay. Anyway, anyway, no, I guess I'm thinking of some way of trying it out to see if there's any way to make it work without going to an ordinance.
So I think Commissioner Colburn wants to chime in here.
Yeah, I had to say my piece at this juncture, right? So I'm torn on it, right? Like, there's part of me that says, Sean, you're 100% right. Like, it's the right, like, moral thing to do, and you should put it out there. And but then I struggle with this law enforcement thing, or how do you enforce it, right? And I think that in terms of the bullwhip on this, it's not very far in the Wayback Machine that, like, all of us sat through, like, I don't know, 2 meetings worth of swim trunk conversation relative to enforcement. And so I believe that if you actually go out there and say this ordinance is there, you're going to have smokers lined up out the door to talk about, I got enforced on and I can't enjoy my park. And so to the extent that we can do this from like a voluntary perspective, whether that's a designated area, some more signage, a combination of the two, And take incremental steps, because I think you're right. Like, over the long term, it probably becomes a ban. But until, like, you make that migration over time, take an incremental step that, and I don't always necessarily believe that there's good in everybody, right? But, like, relative to smoking, a lot of people comply and leverage that in the near term.
Commissioner Long? What happens if we made an ordinance, but the ordinance was nothing? So you can make signs with an ordinance, and 98% of the people probably will just follow it. And the 2% that really get upset about it, and they dig into it, and they find out that there really isn't anything that enforces it. But I think that you get the majority of people.
No.
You're talking about a head fake here, right?
What you're failing to realize is two things. If you create an ordinance, and if you put up the signs, which you're going to end up having to, there will be people who will call and expect a law enforcement response. Now,
if you put up a sign that says smoking banned by ordinance and you don't cite the ordinance and there is no ordinance, I don't think our attorney's office is going to support that very well.
I want to demean myself for a moment, okay? Not because I'm a smoker, because of other things. How often have you heard the statement, I can't believe the cops are doing this when they should have other priorities out there? How often have you seen somebody stopped for a traffic violation and said, I can't believe there's two cops there when all of this other crime is going on? How often? Because if you create the ordinance, folks, people will call. And our policy is we will go. You create the issue. This commission creates that issue. I've had people urge me time and time again, stop going to alarm activations. Alarm activations are one of the largest waste of time in the law enforcement arena all the way across the country. I just met with a national agency last week. 99% false alarm rates. We still go. Okay? We still go. If Miss Betty calls and says somebody is bothering her in the park, we still go. We don't send a park ranger. We still go. But if you create this ordinance, then you eat the bullet on why are the cops doing that when you have other more important things to do.
Now, personally, I see that point, but I guess here is the but. How many times have you been called to come enforce the ban on glass containers?
Other than at normal functions, call it the RSVB type functions, it's very seldom. How often do we go because people are smoking in the parks? That is a common call.
It's a common call already?
Marijuana.
Yeah.
And by and large, we all know where this thing is going. We are going to be faced with these same issues. Our board is going to be faced with the same issues. Our community is going to be faced with these same issues as it goes along. Am I going to cite you for smoking and you for not because you have a marijuana card? And I want to point out another thing. Parks is not well defined. When am I in the park and when am I not? How many walking parks are in this town? And I bring this up because you said that. Parks are not well defined. They don't have a fence around them that says when you step over here, you're in the park. Am I in the park if I'm in the car parked along Highway 50?
Yeah, I guess I wish there was a way, but you said, Roger, yeah, there's not a way to, like, do a pilot program like Donna said. Because, yeah, I mean, if the sheriff's department's getting bombarded with calls to come down and someone's smoking, well, yeah, that's not the intent. I guess, in my mind, the calls wouldn't be that much. But who's to say, because we don't have the ordinance. So, I don't know. So what do we do with this one? What do we do? Should I canvass for votes here?
Listen for Scott.
Scott.
sitting back there, I figured I'd jump into the fray here. For the record, Scott Fehrenbrick, Deputy Director. Kind of along the lines of what Roger was explaining about possibly incorporating designated smoking areas in the park, we already have a good model with the Nevada 150 Fair that it worked, that we had voluntary designated smoking areas. And Chairperson Lehman, you brought up the example about your wife and the fact that it was a large special event and it's in a crowded situation. Maybe we need to focus on the special events versus just the passive use of the parks where people can separate from other people easily, but it's hard to do in a crowded special event. One of the ideas that I thought of in listening to this conversation was perhaps we encourage the special event organizers to create designated smoking areas as part of their event. And then we, in order to help them do it, because we could make it easy for them to do it if we provided, you know, a couple picnic tables here and a couple of picnic tables there. We already have the signage because we had the signage created for the Nevada Fair, Nevada 150 Fair. So we have designated smoking area signs that we could put on temporary A-frames. We could provide the cigarette butt receptacles for them. We could provide the picnic tables and the chairs for them to make it comfortable for them. We could actually even provide some of the pop-up tents if it's during the hot weather months to where we could, just exactly like we did, you know, emulating what we did at the fair. And so if we could encourage these special event organizers to do that, maybe they would comply, you know, on their own rather than make it a requirement that they have designated smoking areas, but just make it easy for them. I think if we said that we, the Parks Division, would come in there and set up those designated smoking areas, I think that would be a good deal for them, and I think that they'd probably think it was a good idea.
Yeah, and you know, you're talking from trying to get a workable solution here, and that's what it's all about. Yeah, I went to the fair. I saw the designated smoking area. There were a couple people using it. I saw one or two or three that weren't, and right, and then you get into a congested area, and people are affected by that. So obviously, this is kind of a hot-button thing with a lot of people because there's different viewpoints. So personally, that's a great idea. I guess I just don't see why we need to make huge accommodations to folks because that would just be more effort for other people. But a good idea. So with that said, anything else, commissioners?
I think probably at this point I'd probably be – I think I'm a – bit mix on the situation, but I'd probably lean a little bit more for doing something not so much of an ordinance, but something on a voluntary, and maybe not necessarily just at one or two parks to test it out, but what's that cost for signs to do it in the parks, similar to like you have the alcohol signs posted, so maybe not completely littering the park with signs, but at least posting them and see how it works. I mean, one of the things is if we're getting minimal amounts of complaints already, it's going to be a tough thing to track probably. But if you could come up with maybe a method of, I guess, tracking it or kind of keeping track of whether you think the volume's gone down versus no sign at all, that's probably the way I'd lean.
Any other comments from anyone?
I'll just real quick, just reiterate, I think the voluntary approach makes sense for us. I agree with Sheriff Furlong. You know, I would like my police force taking care of the bad guys, if you will. I don't like smoking. I grew up in a house with parents that smoked, and personally I don't like it, but I understand the need and the desire for some people to do it, and I think it's a very hard thing to enforce. But I do agree with, you know, we have a community where most people tend to, you know, want to do the right thing, if you will, and if the right thing at a certain situation is not smoke for that 30 minutes you're there, I think most people tend to try to, you know, adhere to that. So I think a voluntary approach is probably a good idea. I was just sitting here and I couldn't help think, you know, when I sit on the school board and I sit here, at some point everything revolves around money. And you drive down the road and you see $1,000 fine for littering, $1,500 fine for littering. And I'd rather get anybody, smoker or whatever, you know, you smoke all you want, but throw the cigarette on the ground. I'd love to see a $1,500 fine just to keep our areas clean. I know. And I tell you what, we
honorary deputy, make me an honorary deputy, I could probably generate $7,000 a day because you just see people tossing stuff everywhere. But anyway, I was just kind of saying that facetiously, but I think a voluntary approach makes some sense here.
Commissioner Curtis.
Yeah, what's the next big event coming up?
Nevada Day.
There's Nevada Day. Is there any way you could measure? I don't know.
Thinking
out loud. That's not really in a park either. There's the RSVP.
Well, there are activities going on at Mills
There's
Park.
There's RSVP,
during,
yeah.
Yeah, during Nevada Day. They got the carnival and other
so
things.
So could you try to think about setting up special smoking areas in Mills Park for the paraders?
That's strictly up to RSVP. They're the ones that have the park. You know, that would be strictly up to the event organizers. That's why I brought up, I don't think what I proposed was not to mandate to special event organizers that they do such, but encourage them to do that. You know, because maybe a lot of times it's not even an idea for them to do that. And I thought, you know, well, if you give them that idea and make it easy for them to do it, that we already have designated smoking area signs, and they go, well, that's a good idea. Maybe we'll provide that, you know, and whether people use those or not, you'd still keep it voluntary.
You know, we don't like the scene. I mean, if you look at the carnival, you've got carnies operating the rides with a cigarette dangling out of their mouth. I mean, you know, so, you know, what kind of an example and everything that's set for the children and the youth. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, we all have individual responsibilities, right? I mean, parents should say, look at that guy smoking. You don't want to be like him, you know.
I can give them the idea that, you know, I can give them a call and say, have you folks thought about creating designated smoking areas? Because we had that conversation at the Park and Rec Commission meeting, and see what they say.
Okay. Certainly could do it at the next fair meeting, too.
Okay, so if this isn't a recommendation for an ordinance, it wouldn't be going to the Board of Supervisors anyway. So I don't think anybody would second me on an ordinance. Am I reading that right? Because I'm not. I'll make a motion, but if there be no second, I guess it's going nowhere. Commissioner McKenna.
I'll second it, but it may fail.
Then if it fails, we'll come up with something else. So I will make a motion to recommend to the Board of Supervisors to consider that the city should move forward with developing an ordinance that bans smoking in city parks. Is there a second?
Second.
Did you hear the motion, Brett?
You want to ban smoking?
Yeah.
In parks.
City parks. All in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed?
Nay.
Okay. Guess you guys aren't doctors.
No, we're not.
Okay, so with that being said, we will move on to the compromise, which I believe is looking for a designated smoking area in city parks and further placement of voluntary compliance signs. Now, that's not going to be an action item. That's just a recommendation to staff.
And, you know, we'll certainly follow up on that recommendation. I mean, we'll talk to a special event holders and ask them if they would consider and encourage them to consider developing designated smoking areas, and we will try to increase our signage program trying to discourage people from smoking in our parks.
So like I did say, I think the signs have worked, so I guess I would recommend to staff if we could put more of them out, particularly at more visible areas to entrances at parks. So
just comment, you know, we're trying to be an enlightened downtown community, I guess. At least that's what I've been hearing. And so right now, you can smoke in casinos, but where else can you smoke downtown?
Outside.
Public streets, outside.
Yeah. I mean, would it be smart of us to consider having designated smoking areas downtown? The business community do something like that, and then people say, oh, aren't these people bright? Let's come and visit.
I think we stick to parks. This is a little bit beyond the scope of this item for open meeting law purposes.
Good idea, though. Commissioner Long.
Roger, do you have a method, kind of just broadly speaking, how do you keep track of complaints or, like, you know, suggestions, whatever it is? Do you have a database you enter these in, or how do you keep track of it?
You know, we don't. We don't really log complaints. But I can tell you, I can tell you that I've been here 10 years now, and I don't recall ever having a phone call of anybody. I don't recall anybody calling me complaining about smoking in parks. Now, I mean, so I guess I don't have to have a database if I have never had a complaint in that case, but no, I've never received a complaint. And again, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, this is a frivolous issue, that just because people aren't complaining, they're not being adversely impacted too.
No, sure. I just think, like, ultimately, in order to really understand something, you have to have something to measure it too. Is kind of, I guess, where I'm coming from.
I have nothing to measure to at this point.
I mean, in fairness, one reason you've probably gotten no complaints because it's not going to go anywhere. I mean,
I think that's a good point.
To complain about.
If we had an ordinance that banned smoking and we had people smoking, I'm sure I'd get more complaints.
Yeah.
Can I chime in? That's a really good point. We do have the ability. The sheriff's office does. Most complaints, I don't want to demean our desk jobs. If a person's going to complain about something that's going on right now, they most often call through the dispatch center. And we, with a little bit of help, we do have the ability to extract that information. We track our calls for service, where they're at, why they're there. The typical calls for service in parks are drunk people, vagrants, homeless people, ironically, guns. This is an open carry state, and so people will go through our parks with guns. Juvenile activities, property damage. These are just some examples. And maybe Roger and I can work together, and on a periodic basis, it would be a great education format for this commission to have access to, okay, how are our parks doing? Let's address out each park, and on a semi-annual or an annual basis, which parks are we having problems in? We do have that ability. I do it all the time, consistently, and in fact, I will tell you that for fun, I do like David Letterman. Every year at the end of the year, I pull up a top 10 call list, and the top 10 places that we go to and the top 10 reasons that we go out. This is a real caring community. I've told Mr. McKenna and the board, the number one call for service in Carson City is to check on somebody else's welfare. So that does go to your profession. That's the number one thing the sheriff's office does. Mills Park is a heavy call volume area. And with those, we can tack on what is the nature of the call. And it would be very educational and informative for this commission to be able to steer how our parks are perceived in this community with that information. Because we certainly don't want somebody going to a park because it's filled with gang members, thugs, drunks, and vagrants. Smokers. I would love to share that information with Roger. I would love to.
All right. I say we share it.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Please bring it back.
Yeah. Good idea. Yeah.
We can bring that information to a future meeting then.
Yeah. Okay. That maybe at the same time you can give us an update on sign deployment.
That'd be a great idea. Okay. Sorry, spent too much time there. Anyway, number four, staff updates. Staff updates. The only reason I kept this on here is I kind of wanted to update on where we are in getting that land.
That's a good point, and that's about the only update I can really give you. Ann Bollinger, who you know is our new open space administrator who succeeded Juan Guzman, and I met with BLM last week on another matter on the resource management plan. They'll be bringing a presentation to you folks, I think, in December, the BLM's regional resource management plan. But we met with them, and during our conversation, we talked and we asked them
where are we in the land transfer process? And still no definite date. They've completed some of the work that needs to be done, the surveying that needs to be done. Now they need to look at utility right-of-ways and that type of thing. But the just to cut to the chase, there's still not a definite date of when we're going to receive that, any of the property. Now, that being said, I guess I can expand my update a little bit. The one area that we have selected, that ridge above Flint Drive, we're starting to have more problems, small problems associated with it in terms of the landfill and expansion, and some requirements now by NDEP about some additional fencing. And, of course, I think we told you a while back that part of that area is going to be a storage area for dirt that's removed in the south leg of the freeway. And so we're really beginning to wonder if that is the most viable location, again, for the for the disc golf course. And while we're waiting for the property to be transferred, maybe we ought to start looking at it. We got a couple other areas that we might think about looking at as a possibility of being suitable disc golf course sites. I really don't want to go into a lot of detail on them right now because they're other city property that may have deed restrictions on the use of that property. And until that's fully explored, we really don't want to bring it up because we don't want to talk about a site that may not pan out because of deed restrictions. But it might be a good idea to start looking at some other sites and some sites that maybe we can facilitate and fast track getting up rather than waiting for BLM land.
When we went on the tour of the different sites, I can't remember, was there a site that kind of floated to the top as the second choice? There was a fair
concern. Oh, I think maybe the second choice might have been.
We had three choices.
Would you come up to the mic?
It seems like there was a pretty good consensus on that Flint Drive site for number one, but I don't recall what number two was.
It seemed like Community College, I think, was on there, although yeah. not great, I guess, obstacles.
Commissioner Long, you're correct. It was the WNC site, it was Carson River Park, and it was the Flint Drive site. Those are the three that floated to the surface as the top three.
Okay. Well, then, yeah, I think those other two we should start thinking about. And we should probably get those disc golf guys back, too, at some point. So, all right. Anything else on that one? Any public comments?
Quick question on that is like next week meeting, should we consider agenda, like putting that on the agenda, or is it?
I think we should have some information for the next meeting.
Okay.
Which we're moving right into number five then. Request for information. So we'll put that on the next meeting. I had a couple quick requests for information. Vern, because you probably know about this one. Up at the waterfall trailhead, there's some stakes and some stuff going on. What's that all about?
That's an open space project, and we're working with the U.S. Forest Service. We're working with the Great Basin Institute and RCI. And what we're looking at doing is building, kind of reshaping the trail up in that location and then putting in a little plaza up there with an information kiosk that gives you information about the trail.
So then, from what I could tell, there's going to be steps, and
there'll be steps and a trail going up to it.
Are you going to take the kind of kiosk that's already there and move it, or there'll be two?
There'll be two kiosks. There'll be the one will still remain, and then there'll be another kiosk. And actually, we should probably bring this plan to you guys. Maybe we can do that for the next meeting as well. But there'll be a paving brick kind of little plaza, small little plaza like a patio, with a kiosk on each side of it. One kiosk would be trail information. The other kiosk, we're going to move that historical sign that's shaped like the state of Nevada that is a memorial to the firefighters and move that over to the other kiosk.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to be a good project. And, I mean, with the new trail coming in from Ash to Kings and with the waterfall trail heading up and hooking into it, in that new kiosk, it might be real nice to have a map or something that shows all the trail system there.
That's the intent. Either we'll have a map or we may go the route that the Tahoe Rim Trail has used and having like little brochures too.
So one other thing I was curious about, request for information, is the C on Carson Hill, the block C, and the flag. Is that city property? Is that BLM? Is that Forest Service? Does anybody know? Can we find out? Who owns that?
Part of C Hill is actually open space property. And Robin Williamson.
There's a nonprofit that was taking care of the C or taking care of the flag, put the flag in, that sort of thing. And people have moved on, and we're looking, or there's some people looking for people to do it, but so far there hasn't been any
effort.
But
is that flag on?
I think it's BLM.
It's on BLM?
I think so. It could also be, I take that back, I'm thinking now it's on private property.
That area up there, there's BLM properties, city property, open space property, and there is private property up there. All in that kind of in the same area.
So I'm wondering if we could find out, because it's kind of pertinent, if that's open space, the block C itself, or is it Forest Service, or I just don't know. But anyway, it does kind of move into school board liaison here, because the block C up there looking like trash lately. It's falling apart. I don't think anyone's taking care of the stuff up there anymore. So I'm wondering who's supposed to be doing that. At one point, it was the school that the athletic teams there, and they haven't been doing it. So it's starting to be like an eyesore of sorts, the sea itself.
I think we probably just need to figure out, we almost need a kind of a voluntary campaign, if you will, just talking to the schools, talking to the community, and making people aware, because most people don't go up there. They see it from a distance. Those of us that go up there, we see it. And it is. It's falling into disrepair, and it needs some attention. But I think if we let the community know there was some organized means of revitalizing that effort, I think people would jump to the chance to help out.
I mean, like that, for instance, would be a great Eagle Scout project.
I will give you a name, and if you want to shepherd that project, you can work with that person.
Okay. So I guess, Commissioner Cassiopo, maybe we worth at least bringing up at a school board meeting, because at one point that block C was put up for the high school. That's why it's there. I've talked to the old timers, and they maintained it for years, and the high school hasn't for a while. It's at least something to talk about.
And one other thing with that is it's always drove me nuts. It's like 50 bags or something of concrete. They're brand new. To set it up, and it was left over, and it rained.
Nobody wanted to take it.
Now we have a 50-bag concrete wall on the entrance up to the flag that was supposed to be,
it's
appealing to the eye, but that concrete isn't. So that'd be cool if we could remove that stuff too, or at least break it down or whatever. So.
No, I think at some point the high school needs to get involved, and we'll talk to your contact. But as the capital city, you don't even have to walk up there anymore. If you look at that sea close, there's big chunks out of it. It's starting to fall apart. So anyway, that was my request. And is there anything else from the school board? No. We're ready to get out of here.
I've got one item. Can we get a report on the trail? As far as I know, the trail from Ash Canyon to Kings Canyon should be finished by the end of this month.
We can get a report on that. Certainly can.
I forget where I was, but I was with the builders, and they said it's done. They need the bridges, so they can't make it official until the bridges are in.
The bridges need to go in. They're building some wire baskets full of rock and that sort of thing for some drainage things. But it's finished work. But I know the trail is completed.
We have a punch list meeting planned, and I can't remember what the date is, but it's later on in October, I think. 28th of October. Yes, because you were invited to that, to walk that trail and to kind of inspect it. And then I believe the materials for the bridge is coming in about the same time, the last week or so of October. I can simply send an email out to you folks if you're interested in that, and give you the timeline. I've got it in my office, just caution you to, I'll blind copy you. Don't get into a serial email conversation. And just if you have any comments, just reply directly back to me and not to each other.
Yeah, and I guess anybody can go work on it this weekend. I think it's Saturday and Sunday they're working on it. So.
Any other requests for information? Okay, number six was future agenda items. Did I hear you right, Commissioner Long? We're going to put the disc golf course on next time. Is that right? Would there be any value in putting that new kiosk at the waterfall trailhead?
Yeah, we can put that on there. We've got a plan. We'll bring the renditions of the plan to show it to you.
Anything else?
Sheriff's report on parks.
Sheriff's report on parks, if available.
Well, whenever. When? I mean, it doesn't have to be next month, but.
When available.
Let's put it on there so.
Mike.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we could just put that down as future agenda items to make sure that we tackle that one.
What else is going on next meeting date?
Well, we tentatively have a review of the 2005.
No, I'm thinking of Election Day.
Yeah, it is. I'm just getting back from Mexico.
So I don't know if we'll have a quorum. That's my whole point.
Yeah, good point. At some point, we talked about not having meetings on Election Day, but.
Or you can change the meeting date. Or you can make sure you have a quorum before you schedule it.
You really can't change the meeting date because that takes an action, and that's not agendized. The other thing, too, is be aware of that when this room is very hard to, you know, to secure because it gets a lot of other uses.
Who knows for a fact they will not be at the next meeting?
You can start there. I was going to know anything till 8 o'clock.
Okay. Murray. Okay. If you are not going to be at the next meeting, please email Roger or myself as soon as possible. So we make sure.
The question would be, is this building available? Because the polls will be open till 7. So.
I just want to make a comment if I can whenever. I don't know when I'm supposed to do it.
Commissioner Curtis has a comment. Go.
Yes, I just wanted to thank, I cut this article out about Costco giving City Parks and Recreation 900 one-gallon multicolor mum plants. And I don't know if anybody can see this, but it was in the paper, and I think it's been mentioned a couple of times, but what a great thing. And thank you, Parks and Recreation, for accepting the plants, because I'm sure you could have gone, oh, my God, you know, what do we do? But